Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and light me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from
past. Alright, alright, alright. Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, 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 jokey time. We've got the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric and Steve coming up in just a couple of minutes. A bar installed 70 Big Mouth Billy Bass in there on the walls to sing in unison. I don't know if you've seen the video of it, but it's pretty awesome. So we're also going to talk about top-selling novelty gifts of all time because there's nothing funnier than novelty gifts. We'll talk a little SNL as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also, subscribe to our podcasts. Every single second of the show is podcast and it's free. You should subscribe and just go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Go to WGNradio.com, subscribe, and it will automatically be sent to you and you can listen at your leisure, bro. It's Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let me say hello to my producer, Tom. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. How are you doing, man?
I'm all right. How was your weekend?
It was a great weekend. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah?
I had a lot of fun. Saw a Marriage Story.
Oh, boy.
Over at the Music Box. And very different. I really enjoyed it, but my girlfriend, whose mom's been divorced twice, had a very different reaction to it.
Yeah.
So it's something I can't even imagine what that would be like to experience that movie from that perspective, but I still really liked it.
Yeah. we'll review that one coming up in just a little bit. Hey, good weekend for the Hawks, man. What's going on now? That's good.
Somebody turned on the Jets.
Exactly, man. Exactly. You know that over the weekend, the Hawks scored 11 points and the Bears scored 7.
Wow.
I just thought I would...
There's your stat of the week.
So, all right, in the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you, buddy?
Just great. How you doing?
Oh, all right. Did you have a good weekend?
Did your team win over the weekend? Mine didn't.
Well, yeah, Hawks did.
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did. 4 in a row for the Hawks.
I may still be cranky after the Bears game, but...
Yeah,
Full disclosure.
Yeah. I know a lot of... I'm not a big, football guy, but I know how everybody is feeling because of my news feed.
Yeah,
and I have many, many Bears fans who are on my Facebook or news feed, and I can always tell when they're not happy.
Yeah, it's not a good effort. Well, it was right there for them to win. I mean, it really, the beginning of that game, we probably should have been at least 6 points on the board before half, maybe 2 touchdowns even. But
yeah, okay. Well, how many games are left?
Too many. they're not mathematically eliminated, I don't think.
Right.
I've been listening to some of the sports critics and things, but that was pretty much a must win.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, we got a break here, we're coming back. We got the Monday morning movie reviews for everything. Vic is in the newsroom. Tom is producing, and I am your host. 312-981-7200. 100, and we got the Monday Morning Movie Reviews coming up right after this. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Monday morning, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We have a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's game as well. And we are also going to talk about some top-selling novelty gifts of all time, and we'll get to some SNL talk as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and we would love to hear from you. Monday also means it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we'll also talk box office. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk movies, and let's get the guys on now. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Welcome back, Steve.
Hello.
All right. Let's get to it. Well, Steve, why don't you tell us about The Kingmaker?
Oh, of course. The Kingmaker is the latest documentary from director Lauren Greenfield, who made two really interesting films about worshipping wealth and wealth culture and the people that do that and live it. One was called The Queen of Versailles, which was probably the better known of the two, and the other one is called Generation Wealth, which is more recent. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise then that she has made her way to centering a film on the indomitable Imelda Marcos in The Kingmaker, who I think people might consider her the first lady of wealth. The film examines with a lot of intimate access the Marcos family's improbable return to power in the Philippines recently. And it also explores the sort of their disturbing legacy of her husband, Ferdinand Marcos's regime, and chronicles Imelda's sort of present day push to push her son, Bong Bong, to win the vice presidency. To this end, Imelda sort of confidently and conveniently rewrites her family's history of corruption and stealing money directly from the Philippine people, and replaces it with a narrative of her sort of matriarchal, extravagant love for her country in an age where fake news manipulation can sometimes change elections. Imelda's comeback story sort of serves as a really dark fairy tale. She was a beauty pageant contestant who snagged this up-and-coming politician, and after 11 days of courtship in the mid-50s, she became his wife and has this sort of long famed history of loving luxury and the power behind her husband's sort of bloody and corrupt regime, which he also allegedly fleeced the nation out of billions, a lot of which sort of ended up in their pockets. But the director, in sort of gaining her subject's participation, it's pretty eager participation too. The director kind of rolls out this incredible tale with obvious parallels in the world, sort of in the current world's other political dynasties going on right now. It's crazy to see her, Imelda Marcos, as she sort of in her day was hobnobbing with people like, and calling them her friends, people like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi and Chairman Mao and Fidel Castro and even Presidents Nixon and Reagan, and even a younger Donald Trump. So the director not only has this sort of access to this 90-year-old Marcos and her family, but she gets to speak to her on subjects such as acquiring stolen art for the presidential palace and the government's continuing attempts to reacquire stolen money or property from the Marcos family. And then also when her husband was president, the necessity of jailing and even killing political enemies, especially those running against them. If you don't like the competition, just have them arrested as revolutionary traitors. That seems to be the way to go with them. there are scenes of Imelda Marcos driving or walking through these poor neighborhoods, just peeling off bills of cash and giving them to poor children that are swarming around her, and she thinks this is a good thing, but it's actually incredibly gross. And naturally, the documentary does sort of talk about her closets that are bursting with expensive gowns and, of course, shoes, which everybody knows her from. But if you think this is a documentary about a woman with a lot of shoes, you're in for a rude awakening. It's really about the way she controls people with this hidden fortune, and just gets what she wants for herself and her family, even still. And it's shocking how many of the Philippine people are still buying what this family is selling. If you think things are bad in this country in terms of corruption and influence peddling, wait until you get a load of what's going on in the Philippines and with the Marcos family, because, man, they knew how to do it right, I guess. And the film is tremendous. It's terrifying. It's shocking. It'll make you angry. And it's playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center through Thursday, and then at some point it's going to land on Showtime, I think.
Yeah, it is a Showtime production. So, yeah. All right. Well, there you go. That's The Kingmaker. All right. Eric, tell us about The Report.
Okay, The Report is a film that premiered at Sundance this year, and it stars Adam Driver as Daniel Jones, who in the late, sometime around 2000, no, I'm sorry, I got those dates wrong. Anyway, he's a congressional staffer who gets tasked with putting together a report that's basically going to detail the level of torture and things that were going on in the post 9/11 world. Sort of think about what was going on during Zero Dark Thirty, and this is the guy in the congressional chambers, basically going through investigating who these people were that were tasked with trying to find the information relating to bin Laden and how all these things basically got out of control. He's on the staff of Dianne Feinstein, who's played by Annette Bening, and this is a pretty stacked cast with a lot of people playing characters in military intelligence, congressional intelligence, people who are on the ground committing these acts as we follow him year after year trying to put together this gigantic report. And then ultimately how this report basically exposed so much that then it became a point of contention within the Congress that it was ever going to be released. It's really kind of interesting to see a lot of names attached to this period in history that have come up quite a bit now with our current administration, and sort of cast a new light on some of those people connected to both realms of history. So this is very much in the sort of an investigative, it's not journalism per se, but it is an investigative story about the really sort of terrible things that have gone on within our government, and it really becomes one of the best examples of this medium. Adam Driver as Daniel Jones, not the first time we're going to be talking about him tonight, but delivers a performance that in many ways is very heavy in exposition. He has to convey a lot of information throughout the film. Even though the director, Scott Z. Burns, who also wrote the movie, does a great job of interweaving the events of the past and his Jones's discovery of them. But Adam Driver has to sort of also represent the audience's sense of outrage that we begin to see. You know, anyone who might think that they have a predisposed manner of what they think torture actually is and how it was perceived during this time is going to walk away with a completely different perspective. And that's one of the great things that this movie does, is that Driver is able to sort of channel that outrage, and we see him getting more and more angry throughout the film, but never in a way that feels showy. It feels like a very natural reaction to the things that he's uncovering. This is a film that even though it's very talky, it's very political, which will probably, you know, keep some people away. But as I said when I saw this movie at Sundance, when we talked about it back in January on your show, this is my favorite movie from Sundance this year. I think this movie is absolutely remarkable, brilliant in the way that it structures this entire, all these weird, these crazy events that were going on post 9/11, and how our government is just, you know, content through political parties and covering up their own asses, make sure that the American public never sees the light of day. And given, you know, what was going on when we saw this in January, it's even more relevant today. This movie came out before the Mueller report, now, or was screened before the Mueller report came out. Now this is after the Mueller report. So there is a really very fascinating parallel now, even more so than before. But I think that this is one of the best movies of the year.
Okay. All right. You guys hang on, okay? When we come back, we'll find out what Steve thought of it and of the report. And we got more Monday Morning Movie Reviews coming up after this on WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood. Player.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking movies. The Monday Morning Movie Reviews, my dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday. We got a Blackhawks Express to play back and all kinds of cool stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Before the break, Eric told us about a movie called The Report, and now we'll get Steve's view on that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, what do you think of the report?
Yeah, I mean, it's exceptional. I think Eric and I might have even seen it together at Sundance. But I should say I'm looking at my bookshelf right now, and I have a 550-page executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture. So, spoiler alert, the people who tried to obstruct its release failed. I can at least say that much. But I think most people might know that. What's really interesting about this film is that, like, Scott Burns, basically by adhering to the facts in an almost religious, with an almost religious fervor, he makes, like, this incredibly believable and riveting thriller. And that's sort of hard to do with just a fact-based drama, which is mostly exposition and some flashbacks. But I should make it clear that this character Jones, he wasn't just trying to talk about the nature of torture and what counted as torture. The most important thing for him was the effectiveness of torture, because if there was any proof in the CIA's documents that he was going through that any of the 100+ people, it was something like 150 or 160 people that they tortured, if any of them had given us any actionable information, he would have thought maybe this was a thing we could continue with. But that's the thing, is that none of that is there. There is absolutely no proof that this ever worked. And that's the thing that just enrages you. And I should mention, like there's like an almost impossible task here with the director to make this incredibly dense story with like 100 characters, it seems like maybe more, to just make it interesting, and it's just like this investigation thing, just make it interesting, and he does it. And I should say, like, at the center of this storm is like Adam Driver, who we're going to talk about again later, like Eric mentioned, and his other role in Marriage Story is probably going to get a lot more talk around award season. But honestly, he is no less remarkable in The Report. It's just a completely different kind of role, so we're really getting a range from him this week. I should also mention a couple other supporting players that really stand out. Ted Levine as CIA Director John Brennan is an amazing performance and character. He's just like an expert liar. John Hamm plays a White House chief of staff, mostly under Obama, I think, Dennis McDonough, who's really the one that's trying to keep the peace between the Republicans and Democrats in terms of this report and sort of trying to appease everybody, which is an impossible task. And then Corey Stoll is Jones's attorney, because Jones gets accused of being a traitor at one point, of course. I wonder if that sounds familiar to the movie I just reviewed. But yeah, they try to throw him under the bus as a traitor, and yeah, Corey Stoll's really great as his very plain-spoken attorney. But yeah, this is a really remarkable film, and I believe it's, where is it? At the Landmark, right? Yeah, and it's going to be on Amazon Prime end of the month, I think.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah. So, but it's tremendous, and I know it. I mean, I can imagine like watching a movie about torture or a torture report, and we do see some examples of it in the movie in the flashbacks. Doesn't sound like the most interesting way to spend an afternoon or an evening at the movies, but man, just go because Adam Driver is like the coolest actor right now. Honestly,
right.
Like, it makes me more excited to see him in Star Wars the next month. So,
yeah. Okay, all right. Well, there you go. That's the report, and two great reviews from there. Okay, Steve, tell us about The Good Liar.
Yeah, so you'd imagine that a combination of Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen acting in a film for the first time together would seem like a foolproof combination, especially in the hands of a director, Bill Condon, who has worked with McKellen on things like Gods and Monsters and Mr. Holmes, and even more recently in the live-action Beauty and the Beast. And while the two leads in The Good Liar are quite compelling when they're on screen together, there's a serious disconnect between them and the material that by the end is kind of unforgivable. We know pretty much from the opening that Roy Courtney, who McKellen plays, is a con artist who seems to target rich businessmen along with his professional partner Vincent, who's played by Jim Carter from Downton Abbey. They present what appears to be legitimate, lucrative investment opportunities and end up stealing fairly large sums of money from their marks. And it's their sort of knowledge of the language of business that makes them believable and a success for the most part. So we're never really quite sure initially if Roy has targeted this well-off widow, Betty, who's played by Mirren, who he meets on an online dating service. We don't know if he's targeted her because of her money or if he's actually looking to settle down with someone because he is, you know, he's a single man. But when he finds out how much money she has, he's immediately gets in touch with Vincent and starts trying to get her interested in investing her millions in ways that will supposedly make her a giant sum of money in a short amount of time. But along the way, the speed at which Roy and Betty become close worries her adult grandson, and there's even a part of the entire arrangement that makes us think Roy might actually be falling for her, or perhaps reconsidering ripping her off. At some point, we think his cover is blown when the couple and the grandson take a vacation to Berlin, and Stephen, the grandson's name is Stephen, he reveals that he's found out that Roy isn't all that he says. But when Roy explains things from a certain perspective, Betty is all the more drawn to him and his reasons for his deception, which have nothing to do with him trying to swindle her. It's just, but it's still pretty juicy. The Good Liar sort of falls apart in the third act big time, though. My biggest issue with the film is that under no circumstances could I buy Helen Mirren as a hapless, naive victim. She's built a career playing tough, intelligent, cunning characters, so I never quite bought that she would be taken in by Roy's plan to combine their finances and invest them together. But the bigger crime here, I think, is that when the entire truth about the situation is revealed, it's so convoluted and outlandish that I had a tough time accepting any of it, to be honest. And more importantly, the film turns into a bit of a mystery by the end that has given the audience absolutely no clues by which to solve it. I mean, I like having fun in my mysteries and playing along with them, and you can't, there's none of that here. We're just asked to accept this fairly insane reveal and just think, well, how about that? What do you know? And but I actually, you know, the film doesn't really offer any opportunities to try to guess what's going on. Condon is usually a lot better, I think, with his storytelling skills, so maybe it's more a fault of the writing than the directing. But as a filmmaker, I kind of expect him to recognize that the shift in tone is so abrupt and jarring and maybe do something to ease the kind of gotcha moment rather than just sort of drop it on our heads. So if all you care about it in going to see The Good Liar is watch these two acting powerhouses come together, your wish will be granted tenfold. But if you'd actually like to see them interact in a worthy setting, this film is going to be something of a letdown.
Okay. All right, Eric, what'd you think?
Yeah, this is not a good movie. It's almost as if Bill Condon like threw Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and The Grifters into a juice extractor, and the only thing that came out was, you know, just the plotting, but everything, you know, everything except the sort of the sense of fun and even the sort of the cheekiness about it. And you know, every once in a while watching this movie, you kind of get the sense that that's a direction that Condon kind of wants to be playing with a little bit, especially in when he sees McKellen's sort of dealings up close, which, you know, just the way they're presented just seem kind of silly. A bunch of people in a room and they got a couple keypads. I mean, keypads are such a thing in this movie that is just so just ridiculous that you know, no one uses like a laptop or anything. They're all using these keypads and things to they launder all their or to transfer all their money and whatnot, as if they, you know, that's the only thing that an audience is going to be interested in. And then, like, you know, Steve is absolutely right about the sort of the third act, which is, you know, semi-spoiled by the trailers a bit in suggesting that, you know, that Helen Mirren's character may not be all that she's cracked up to be. And as Steve said, that there's no way to not only not predict what, you know, where the, you know, where this entire plot has been sort of sprung from, but it also just sort of gives you an even worse reason to dislike one of the characters that just seems like, I mean you can't sit there and think, oh, there's no, you know, that there is an excuse for anything that this character has done in the past, but it just it almost seems unfair to him as a character to just sort of throw this upon us at the last minute and go like, oh, so we should feel bad about ourselves for, you know, maybe kind of wanting him to get away with certain things. It all completely falls apart by the end, like Steve said, and there wasn't much to keep apart or keep together to begin with. This is a pretty big pass for me.
Okay. All right, you guys, hang out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. We're reviewing the new movies. We got more going on here, and Monday morning movie reviews continue. And that was The Good Liar with Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. Not very good, according to the Eric and Steve. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. My dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time on this Monday morning. We have a Blackhawks Express to play back from a very exciting, good weekend for the Hawks. We're going to talk about some SNL stuff and some top-selling novelty gifts of all time. So, that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews is happening right now. And it's Eric and Steve, and let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay. Eric, tell us about Charlie's Angels.
Okay. Well, this is the latest incarnation reboot of the you know, classic, if you will, 1970s television show with a bunch of beautiful women who just happen to be spies and go on adventures. The latest Angels begin with Kristen Stewart and Ella Balinska, who we see on a secret mission as the movie begins, and then we discover a little bit more about the agency itself. In fact, all of the Charlie's Angels versions that we've seen throughout time all seem to be connected in some manner. In fact, there's actually multiple Bosleys. We see the first Bosley in the movie is played by Patrick Stewart, who is the retiring Bosley, and he is going away, going his merry way, and the Angels that we meet are taken over by Elizabeth Banks's Bosley. Banks also wrote, produced, and directed the movie. So the new the new adventure for the girls, or for the women, is this tech case of this woman played by Naomi Scott, who has developed this some sort of energy device that has a fatal flaw in it. In fact, it can cause gigantic seizures in people, and only a few people are aware of this, but of course the tech company still wants to go through with it. She's been hired by another sort of entrepreneur to sort of expose what's going on. The Angels get involved, and everyone wants to basically kill each other, and then she ends up becoming the third Angel. So we have two bona fide Charlie's Angels, and we have a newbie on the case, as they are going to put together who's exactly behind all of the murders and things, and, you know, go on their own merry ways. So, you know, Charlie's Angels, we're not exactly here for the plotting. We're here for the adventures, for the butt-kicking, maybe a couple chuckles along the way. And in the past, we've, you know, certainly delighted at the eye candy that the show was basically, you know, announced itself with, and has been sort of kind of a staple throughout the years. Although as we have grown as a society, there's certainly been a aura of feminism. Not that that wasn't existent in 1977, but it was certainly a mixture of the two things to get both sexes interested in the storyline. Here, the focus is pretty squarely on feminism, as evidenced in the very opening scene, as Kristen Stewart and even some of her marks are espousing a lot of tropes that we hear from time to time about you know, things that are going on in society and things that are absolutely supportive. But as the movie sort of progresses, it kind of just puts that aside a bit, and it just sort of feels like the entire enterprise just becomes more generic as it goes along. The only one here that I think is really sort of into this entire thing, beyond Banks, who's put everything into this, is Kristen Stewart. Her character, even though she is the lead, Naomi Scott's character certainly takes front and center throughout a good portion of this movie, and Stewart is really gives a really sort of unique comic flavor to her character. The line readings that are just kind of weird. She, you know, she just kind of gets the best quips in the movie. But the movie just becomes more and more bogged down with action scenes that are not exactly, nothing in the film really stands out. The plot goes on for, you know, a good 2 hours. You can guess exactly what's going to happen, who the surprise mystery villain is not hard to guess in the slightest. And it ultimately just kind of fall somewhere in the middle. You know, we've had the McGee versions back in 2000 and 2003, and the first one I thought kind of struck the right balance of silliness that is kind of existed throughout this entire enterprise. Full Throttle, the sequel, was a lot uglier and a lot louder. It was not nearly as enjoyable, I thought. And this one kind of comes in somewhere in the middle. It's not really noisy. It's not really that silly. It's just kind of in the middle. And I think it's kind of a mistake to have a outsider be one of the three primary leads in the film. It just at least sort of a naivete that an audience going in to see a Charlie's Angels movie doesn't really need. We kind of get what this entire thing is. We don't need her, you know, getting goo-goo-eyed at, you know, second closets full of clothes and stuff. So, yeah, so by the end, I just kind of shrugged, and apparently most of America did as well.
Yeah, okay. All right, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I liked it more, but it's not great, and I didn't love it. But I did like it. I mean, the only reason that I liked it as much as I did is because of Kristen Stewart. And I'm glad Eric was the one who had to explain the plot, because I don't even remember it anymore. The plot is arbitrary. It's pointless, and the villains are basically two-dimensional. I like what Sam Claflin was doing a little bit. He's the tech guy, the head of the tech company. I kind of like that he's taken this sort of bad guy turn recently. So, there's a bunch of predictable twists. But Banks, I think, as a director, understands that when she keeps focus on her leads, everything is pretty much all right. I think the only real interesting male character is this guy they call Saint, who's sort of part Q, part spiritual guru to the angels, and there's something so ridiculous about having a person like that in an action movie that it kind of works because it's new and unexpected. There's an early scene in the film where Kristen Stewart's character, Eric alluded to the moment where there's a discussion that's sort of about feminism, but she has a line in it where she says something about how being beautiful is an advantage in her job because no one suspects how dangerous she can be, and that is the entire end of the movie is sort of built around that in a really clever way, I think. And we realize that Charlie doesn't just hire pretty women because he likes having them around, he or she, I should say, but that Charlie knows that in a world run mostly by men, that these beautiful women are an asset to his intelligence gathering and just general spying. I got to say, though, but Kristen Stewart, man, after about 20 years of playing such serious roles, it's absolutely fascinating to watch her character emerge out of her with such unexpected layers. And she might be a sociopath, the character, but she's sort of weirdly sexy and quirky and kinky, and she has no real filters or boundaries when it comes to fighting bad guys or protecting her fellow agents. Things just come out of her mouth, and you like have to take a breath before allowing your brain to move forward sometimes. It's a tremendous comedic performance that doesn't really involve joke telling, but it absolutely informs the character. And I remember when I first saw the trailer for this film, I'm like, what the hell is she doing in this movie? And now that I've seen it, I get it. Like, she's trying something so different, and I applaud her for that. She's stealing the show and making the movie better than it has any right to be. By doing the unexpected and making it count for something. And, you know, as a girl power guiding light, you could do a lot worse, I think, than Kristen Stewart and Charlie's Angels. So,
yeah, she's great. She's great. I love Kristen Stewart. I think she's fantastic. And I think she's by far the best thing in this movie. This is about as pedestrian as it gets. We've seen this stuff before. Elizabeth Banks doesn't do anything very special with the material. And, you know, I don't think we needed another Charlie's Angels. I really don't. You know, the two movies, I didn't like either of the movies. The TV show was, you know, whatever it was back in the 70s. I just don't see the need for another one. Apparently, Elizabeth Banks thought there was. But I'm almost recommending this just because of her, just because of Kristen Stewart. It's such a great performance, and it's funny, and it's weird, and it's awesome. But everything else about this movie is pretty much by the numbers and not surprising or, you know, nothing unique or anything like that. Doesn't add anything to the world of Charlie's Angels of any kind. But this performance by Kristen Stewart, she's become such an unbelievably interesting actress. You know, if you would have told me this, that I would find her one of the most fascinating actresses on the planet when the Twilight movies were out, I would have told you to shut up. But between her and Robert Pattinson,
we've had this conversation before.
It's unbelievable how far these two have come and what the kind of work they're doing. Robert Pattinson in The Lighthouse, one of the best performances of the year, mm-hmm. and she's great in this movie. And it's really, I mean, she's almost singularly the only reason to see it. I really love her. I think she's great. And the movie, not so much, but she's great. So, all right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We're going to take a quick break. We got more movies to talk about on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio is here, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We've got a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's victory. Good weekend for the Hawks, man. And we've got we're going to talk about novelty gifts and some SNL stuff, too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's the movie reviews with Eric and Steve, and let's get the guys back in. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Steve, tell us about Ford versus Ferrari.
Yes. I think we can all agree that we've gotten to the point where I just sort of trust James Mangold as a director. Like, I just am pretty sure he's going to get it right. I'm not saying every one of his films has been great, but, like, he always finds a way to tell a story in a way that is revealing and informative and insightful. When you look at recent things like Walk the Line or 310 to Yuma, and both the Wolverine and Logan, and even going back to his earliest stuff like Heavy and Copland, the proof is there. His latest effort, he's returning to the realm of telling true life stories with Ford versus Ferrari, which chronicles one of the most important events in American car race design and racing, when the Ford Motor Company went head-to-head with the unbeatable race cars of Enzo Ferrari at the 24 Hours of Le Mans competition in France, circa 1966. Honestly, I could care less about racing movies or movies about race cars, but if you skip this film because you think it's a racing movie, you're going to kind of be denying yourself what I think is a rare treat. Matt Damon plays a former racer turned legendary car designer, Carroll Shelby, who Ford hires to build a car that could not only be competitive at Le Mans, but actually win. Then Ford Motor Company head Henry Ford II, who's played wonderfully entitled and pompous by Tracy Letts, and his underling Lee Iacocca, who's played by John Barenthal, both trusted Shelby implicitly, but also repeatedly poisoned the process of testing various prototypes by allowing Ford's right-hand man, Leo Bebe, who's played by Josh Lucas, who you absolutely want to punch by the end of this film, who kept interfering with talk of things like doing things the Ford way and wanting to change design elements that didn't help the car actually get faster. And one of the ways he did that was by questioning Shelby's choice of the person who's actually going to drive at Le Mans, a British driver named Ken Miles, who's played by Christian Bale, who's, I'm guessing, his biggest flaw to Ford was that he wasn't American, but he also was a bit rough around the edges, especially with authority figures, so much so that he had trouble finding steady racing work, even though the guy consistently won. Miles was also a master at testing each new race car to make it more and more perfect, and eventually he did make his way to Le Mans. And I think Miles is by far the most interesting character in the film, if for no other reason than we see him outside of his racing environment. His extraordinary wife, Molly, who's played by, I'm going to get her name wrong, Catriona Balfa, understands what makes him tick, like few others do, and his young son Peter, who's played by Noah Jupe, who we'll talk about next week in a movie called Honey Boy, and he worships his dad and the cars that he works on. Ford versus Ferrari is not exclusively a racing film, but the sequences that involve racing are, I think, exceptionally crafted using camera work, and I'm assuming special effects, to create something so immersive and dangerous that you'll find yourself probably flinching and sweating right along with the drivers. The perspective we get as other drivers wreck around Miles is terrifying, and they also really get a good sense of that sort of loopy tunnel vision that they get, especially when they're driving at night, and it feels death-defying. Mangold and his team make this type of street racing seem as dangerous as I'm sure it is, and make you want Miles just to finish alive. But every race features drama on and off the track, especially involving Shelby, again, battling last-minute adjustments with the Ford team, who want to introduce things during the race, even, like new elements. The ultimate insult comes during Le Mans when Miles is asked to slow his lead to let two other Ford drivers catch up so they can potentially cross the finish line at the same time. In a strange way, this may be one of the few films that you'll ever see that practically advocates towing the line as a company man when the moment seems right, or if you know, just don't want to lose your job. There's a weird air of desperation to a lot of Ford versus Ferrari. These guys are kind of in it not for the money, but just because it's their life. Sometimes that desperation also comes from Henry Ford, who feels like he's being judged by those around him for just not being the success that his father was. But often the desperation comes from Shelby and Miles, who know that they can do the job if only they've been left to their own devices. It's an age-old story of visionaries being stifled by these small-minded weasels who just happen to run the show. And a great deal of the movie becomes these two impressive men finding creative ways not only to design cars but to avoid the brass. Like the cars they built, the film is greater than the sum of its parts, and it's another, in my estimation, it's another feather in the cap of superior storytelling by James Mangold.
Okay. All right. Eric, what do you think?
It's one of my lesser James Mangold films, actually. I could just never sort of rev up a decent level of engagement with the story. For me, a lot of it felt a bit too by the numbers. Even at 2.5 hours, and a lot of potentially really interesting storylines, I think, themes that they could have explored a bit further in this movie. They just seem to just go around and round the circles, which is exactly why I've never been interested in racing to begin with. Not that you need to be completely interested in racing, though I think that anyone who is a racing fan will get more from this movie than I did. And something Steve sort of talked about there, a bit, is I think one of the reasons why I had a problem early on in sort of really finding my lane, if you will, with this movie, in that it essentially is the story of one giant American corporation trying to seek revenge on a foreign corporation. And the entire movie, even though it's mostly told through the eyes of the lesser people on the totem pole, namely Damon and particularly Bale, there's still this sense that they're working for the man, and they're just trying to gain more glory for a group that was slipping at the time financially, and this is a way for them to sort of work their way back into the global consciousness. And I thought that they could have leaned a little bit more into the idea of Bale being the character that certainly knows more than anyone else in the film about cars, and certainly about driving cars, but he's just so temperamental that no one wants to listen to him, and instead of him being the guy that has the real sense of expertise, and because he's lower on the totem pole, he's eventually going to get screwed, and eventually when things transpire in that direction, it just feels like It didn't quite register, and maybe, you know, because of the length of the movie, and I was just sort of growing more and more disengaged with it as it went along. I wanted more, a bit more between Bale and Damon at odds with each other. I think those are some of the better scenes in the movie. You know, Josh Lucas shows up and does this role. It may as well just be deemed the Josh Lucas role from here on out, because that's exactly what I expect from Josh Lucas when he shows up in a movie nowadays. Yeah, I mean, Tracy Letts does some good stuff as Henry Ford, but ultimately at the end, I didn't feel that engaged with the story.
Okay, all right, let's take a break, guys. Hang on. Mm-hmm. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ford versus Ferrari, and then we got another movie to review right after we take a break here on 720 WG. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express from last night's victory. Great weekend for the Hawks. Really, really great. And we also have top-selling novelty gifts of all time. We'll talk a little SNL as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. And Eric and Steve are here. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
I'm kind of in the middle of both of you guys on this one, Ford versus Ferrari. There were parts of it. First of all, I think it's way too long. And it goes, it's, you know, I don't really, there's no need for this movie to be 2.5 hours long. So it feels very long. There were some compelling things in it. And I thought the chemistry between Matt Damon and Christian Bale was really terrific. I think they worked very, very well together on screen. And Christian Bale is just, he's just so great to watch in anything. And he's very, very, very good in this movie. I thought Tracy Letts was awesome. I mean, I happen to love Tracy Letts, but I thought he was awesome in this. It was a nice, juicy role for him, you know, in this, like, a prestige movie. Interesting. I thought the movie was interesting in terms of, you know, the historical aspect of it. I didn't know a lot about this. This is not, you know, not one of my, I'm not a racing guy. I'm not a car guy at all. So this is not in my wheelhouse at all. But I was pretty much compelled for most of it. It was hard for me to care. You know what I mean? About what was happening in the movie. There was no emotional heft to it. There was nothing on the line for me. I just didn't find it as compelling as I could have. But everything about it is like beautifully mounted. It's a good looking movie. It's well cast. Lots of really good performances in it. You know, it's a story that I don't find very compelling. And you know, even if I'm not interested in a topic, I should be able to watch a movie about it, but I was not compelled by this at all. Good performances all the way around, good looking movie, I wouldn't not recommend it to a lot of people, but I was hindered by it, didn't care really, and it was too long. So those are my thoughts. Okay, Steve?
Yes.
Tell us about Marriage Story.
All right. Buckle in.
Yeah.
So this is the latest from writer-director Noah Baumbach, who has given us an incisive and compassionate love story, but told from the perspective of a marriage breaking up, but hopefully a family kind of staying together. Our buddy Adam Driver is back as Charlie, a New York experimental theater director, and his wife is Nicole, played by Scarlett Johansson, who is the lead actress in most of his shows. is. She had a little bit of fame when she was a teenager and really hasn't had any, but getting involved in his theater group has sort of benefited both of them because it's made her a higher profile actress and made him, and as a result, that has made him a higher profile theater director. She gets a TV pilot offer in L.A., where she was born and raised, and heads out there with their young son while Charlie continues to prep work for their upcoming show. The agreement was that she'd shoot the pilot and return to New York, but Nicole not only is reminded of how much she missed L.A., but that their agreement when they first moved to New York was that they would eventually return to California, and that's the thread that the fabric of their marriage unravels from. They're a young, hip couple, so they believe they can figure out their divorce without lawyers, but using a mediator. And but when they start to fight about custody and where their son's going to live, out come the lawyers, including her very sharp attorney, played by Laura Dern, and his slightly less sharp, sharp as a marvel maybe, a lawyer played by Alan Alda, who is later replaced by a genuine shark, played by Ray Liotta. If you do have just one takeaway from Marriage Story, it's that lawyers suck and that all they're good for is draining bank accounts. I think we can all agree on that. But the other, like, my guess is that your reaction to Marriage Story is going to be partially determined by the baggage you bring into it, either like by a personal experience or that of someone you know. The truth is, Baumbach is very careful not to make either Charlie or Nicole the bad guy. They both make mistakes. They're both selfish in equal measure at different times, because they both still love each other and would rather not be a part of this process, although some of the events that leads to, you may think differently. There's an incredible sequence in Charlie's new L.A. Apartment that is a hostile screaming match like no other they've ever had, probably. They just unleash every pent-up emotion about their situation almost from the day they met, and it is one of the toughest scenes I've had to watch all year. There are times when you're likely to cry, especially in scenes involving lists that the couple make during counseling, that list the things that made them fall in love with each other in the first place. And they're read at different, very key moments in the movie, and it's incredibly emotional. The idea that Johansson was going through a divorce during the making of this movie is almost too awful and perfect. Marriage Story is a film built on pure emotion. It's sometimes very funny and very sweet, and at other times relentless and difficult to handle. It's interesting that one of Baumbach's earliest films, The Squid and the Whale, was also about divorce, but told from the child's point of view, and he's grown as a filmmaker. He's been through some things, and this film reflects that beautifully. I think it's one of the year's best, and I feel like we've been saying that a lot lately, but I think it's true. And it's I should mention, because it's my job, that it's playing exclusively in Chicago at the Music Box Theater in 35mm, and then it debuts on Netflix on the 29th.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, this movie is an experience. And I have known people that have gone through divorce, probably not with firsthand knowledge directly, but I've known them. I've never been married myself, but between this and Gone Girl, I don't think I ever will. everything Steve said about this is correct. You could pretty much label best of attached to just about anyone associated with this movie. And I have, Nick, you pointed this out when I reviewed the movie from Toronto, that, Noah Baumbach has not exactly been my cup of tea over the years. There have been a few things that I like Greenberg and the Meyerowitz stories, but other things that have drawn great praise, like Francis Han, even The Squid and the Whale, to an extent, I have not been really on board with. But this is a home run. This is an absolute home run. And like Steve said, these lists, which is this is sort of this brilliant framing device that Baumbach opens the movie with, really kind of sets us up for the this roller coaster ride of you know, how we're going to, you know, interpret these people. You know, I mean, we might feel like we want to, you know, side with one over the other and go into our corners, men supporting the men, women supporting the women, and whatnot. And, you know, up to the point that the papers are delivered, when they finally, when one character finally decides that this is what has to be done in order to sort of make the next step in their lives, it's ultimately, like, the funniest scene in the movie, and you know, also the most heartbreaking in the way that it transpires, and that's you know a way that this movie goes through. I mean, the once the lawyers get involved, then we kind of are given villains in a way. But at the same time, if you're supporting what these characters are going through, you kind of realize that some of the advice that they're getting from their lawyers is kind of absolutely essential to them to get what they need and want. You know, the three lawyers, Laura Dern is unbelievable in this movie. Unbelievable. You want to talk about, you know, we just talked about Charlie's Angels and it's sort of speechifying about feminism. Waiting to hear Laura Dern talk about it in this movie. It's, you know, it's like, you know, it's cutting you with glass. Alan Alda is the sort of the nicer lawyer, is kind of the guy you don't want to be representing you in a way. And then Ray Liotta has not been this good in years. Ray Liotta is fantastic in this movie. Praising Adam Driver is just comes with the territory. He's spectacular in this movie. I think this is the best thing Scarlett Johansson has ever done. I don't think she's ever been better in a movie. This fight sequence that Steve referenced. Fights between couples in movies, I think more often than not, tend to feel written. They tend to feel phony. This is the best verbal fight sequence I've seen since Before Midnight. It's at that level. And as movies about divorce, this ranks up there with Shoot the Moon and The War of the Roses. And I think that Baumbach has crafted something that a lot of couples, this movie might even cause a few divorces, who knows. But at the same time, it might, you know, in a time that so many people need to find healing in some way and find peace through themselves and for their families, this feels like an essential piece of cinema that a lot of people will need to experience.
Okay. Hang on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric, Steve, hang on. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of Marriage Story, and then we got the box office to talk about, too, right here on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We're talking about the Monday morning movie reviews. Here is Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, this movie killed me. you know, I've been divorced twice, and it's not a pleasant thing. The one thing about the only positive thing about the two times that I have been divorced is that you know there were no kids involved, and essentially no lawyers. And so watching this movie was just it depends. You know, like what you were saying, Steve, is like when you bring like your own baggage to it.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot of baggage when it comes to this kind of stuff, and this is just an incredibly powerful movie that works on every single level. It's devastating at times. It's also funny at times. Adam Driver, you know, is fantastic, but Scarlett Johansson is unbelievable. And as you mentioned, Steve, the fact that she was going through a divorce when they made this movie. I don't even know what to say. This is as powerful a movie as you're going to see all year. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. And you were right, Eric, when you reviewed it. Where'd you see it? Sundance?
Toronto.
In Toronto. It was. You were absolutely right when you were like, you know, you compared it to Shoot the Moon, and that's high praise because Shoot the Moon, to me, is one of my favorite. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. One of the greatest movies ever made about divorce, without question, and a devastating movie on every level. And this is right up there. And that's, for me, that's incredibly high praise considering how much I love Shoot the Moon. But this is a beautiful movie. It's absolutely beautiful. Now, I'm a Bombeck fan, Eric. I know you're not really, but I've pretty much been on board with all of his movies, without question. But I think this might be the best thing he's ever done. So it's a devastating film. It is, but it's absolutely brilliant. I think one of the best movies of the year. So.
Let me add one thing that, just because Eric mentioned something about that fight scene that, yeah. I've seen a couple interviews with Scarlett Johansson talking about shooting this. And she said that every single word, every pause, every broken sentence is scripted. Mm. And if you missed one word, you would have to shoot the scene again.
Oh, man.
So, like, nothing in here is improvised, even though especially that scene feels just so raw and right off the top of their very angry heads.
Yeah.
But, man, every word is scripted. And I got to say, like, it's like doing a play. Like, it's you have to get it right. And that just makes it all the more remarkable when you actually see it.
Yeah. It's also weird. I brought a lot of baggage to this one as well because, you know, my first wife was an actress that I directed in plays.
So, you should be suing for royalties.
It got under my skin, man, big time. So, anyway, all right. Well, there you go. Marriage Story, one of the best movies of the year, playing at the Music Box. What do we got next week?
A lot of stuff, actually. We got Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Hanks. We got Frozen 2.
Yeah.
Steve mentioned Honey Boy, the Shia LaBeouf film. 21 Bridges is next week with Chadwick Boseman.
Oh, that's next week? Oh, I thought that was... Okay, all right.
No, it's next week. And Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo, the Todd Haynes film.
Yeah.
And Waves, Trey Edward Schultz's
film. By the way, we're not on next week. I'm on vacation for Thanksgiving week, so we won't be reviewing anything. We'll play catch up the following week. Okay,
we'll be reviewing Knives Out then too.
Okay, yeah, God, I can't wait.
Make a point, Nick, of seeing Honey Boy though.
I will.
I think you're gonna love it.
Yeah, I definitely will. Okay, guys, we'll talk to you. Steve, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, buddy. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, man. And then Eric, you're gonna stick around here.
Yeah,
and we'll talk box office.
Sounds good.
Okay, so the number one movie of the week is Ford versus Ferrari at $31 million. That, to me, seems more than I would ever have expected it to make. I don't know why.
When I originally was, you know, weeks ago, maybe over a month ago, looking at the numbers for this, I thought that this might be, you know, kind of like a $60, $70 million film overall.
Yeah.
Draw a little, you know, general interest and, you know, kind of fade away. But, no, I mean, the closer I got to it, the more, I mean, they've been advertising the hell out of this movie. Looking at just the way that this thing is going to play out, I mean, this thing seems destined it's going to be in the top five probably until mid-December. And I think that, you know, the $31 million opening that it started with, you know, this is a very good chance of getting over $100 million.
Yeah, I never would have thought that. I was fascinated by the fact that it made $31 million. I just never would have thought that.
Well, it's funny that, you know, because, like, I don't know if I mentioned this at Toronto, but it seemed like everyone out of Toronto was going around describing it as, like, oh, this is going to be your dad's next favorite movie. not your, but just everybody's dad's next favorite movie.
That's great. That's actually a really great way to describe it, actually. All right. Man, there's a big drop-off between number one and number two.
Yeah.
Midway, $8.7 million, $35 million total.
Yeah, this is bad. I said this last week, you know, Midway, you know, kind of shocked everyone by hitting the number one spot, but that was not a good number for a $100 million production.
Yeah.
That is probably going to have limited international appeal. So the fact that this movie is, you know, probably headed, you know, to less than $60 million in the U.S. is just not a good sign for this movie.
Yeah, wow. Boy, number three, Charlie's Angels, only $8.6 million. People do not want to see Charlie's Angels, I guess?
No. No, No, and despite what Elizabeth Banks is now coming out and saying about it, which is really unfortunate, I think that their first clue should have realized that in 2011, we didn't bring this up, but if you remember, they tried to reboot the TV series.
That's right.
In 2011, and it lasted 3 weeks.
Yeah.
On the air. 3 weeks for, you know, a name recognition reboot of a television show. And, you know, why they thought that 8 years later, you know, bringing it back. And frankly, you know, not that people weren't, you know, not that they just weren't interested in it, but I don't think they helped themselves at all. You know, Kristen Stewart's really the only name in the movie.
Yeah.
People don't, you know, really know who the other two women are, you know, fortunately for them.
Yeah.
And I think that hurt it big time.
Yeah, I agree, but that's still a much lower amount of money than I thought it was than I thought it would make.
Yeah, it's bad.
Bad. Number four, Playing with Fire, $8.5 million, $25 million total for your John Cena comedy.
Yeah, probably headed to somewhere in the vicinity of $40 million, but you know, they spent, you know, not a great bit of money on this, but enough that this is not looking like a hit either.
Yeah. Number five, Last Christmas, $6.7 million, $22 million total.
Yeah, same bag, probably going to be somewhere around $35-36 million, and it's pretty well internationally, I guess, this weekend, so they might be able to save it overseas.
Okay. Boy, oh boy, Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, man. $6.1 million, $25 million total. What the hell?
Yeah, you know, people, 2.5 hour Stephen King adaptation in November. People said, no, do that later, do that earlier.
Yeah.
And this thing, you know, might not hit $35 million.
That's a shame, too, because I think it's terrific.
I agree.
Yeah. Number seven, The Good Liar, $5.6 million.
Yeah, certainly not a great number. I think a little bit better than some people expected. Only a $10 million budget, though, and probably you'll draw a few bit of interest overseas. So not exactly a catastrophe for Warner Brothers.
And then Joker continues to make money. It's up to $322 million just in America.
The first R-rated film ever to gross $1 billion.
I don't understand this at all.
I just don't get it. And if you believe the reports, the film that Donald Trump watched in the White House last night.
Oh, okay. All right. Number nine, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, $5.2 million, $106 million total. That's significantly less than the first one made, right?
Certainly domestically, yeah. I mean, it's going to come in around $250 million less than worldwide than it did, but $140 million of that is just here in the U.S.
Jeez. All right, and then number 10 is Harriet, $4.7 million, $31 million, almost $32 million total, which is pretty solid, right?
Yeah, it's not a bad number for a small budget of film, Cozy Lemons, you know, $31 million for that, for, you know, a history movie that, you know, they kind of had some Oscar hopes for. I don't know if that's going to come to fruition.
Yeah.
But the fact that made the top 10, and you notice what title we did not mention in the top 10 this week.
Which is?
Terminator.
Oh, well, yeah.
Here's the stat of the week for you. Terminator Dark Fate, the first movie to open at number one and not spend 3 weeks in the top 10 at the box office since Texas Chainsaw 3D. In 2013.
Wow. All right. There's a fact for you right there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What are we?
2 weeks in the top 10 Terminator spent.
Wow. Man, oh, man. Well, what are we looking at next week for, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff is coming out. What do we think is going to be the biggest one?
Frozen 2 is going to be huge, and I think Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is going to be a very solid second as well. I think that that, and especially over Thanksgiving, I think that movie is going to be this year's wonder.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait. I can't wait to see it. Okay, well, there you go. We're off next week. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too, man.
All right, Eric. Take care, buddy. There you go. Eric and Steve will be back. I'm off next week, so we'll be doing it in a couple of more weeks. And we're getting to the year-end stuff, too, which is going to be fun. All right, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Down in Louisiana. Saturday. You got your granny.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6 o'clock is Steve Cochran with your morning drive on this Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. All right. Poke Salad Annie. Yeah, man. 262 area code says, I saw Ford versus Ferrari coming out of the theater, got on my phone, and immediately downloaded Poke Salad Annie. I forgot how good that song was. Secondly, I looked up more about Ken Miles, unsung hero in American racing as far as I'm concerned. Last but not least, a lot of people got into their cars thinking that they were racers doing burnouts. One car coming out of the parking lot actually got into an accident. Yeah. I think that happens after every Fast and Furious movie. People suddenly think they're, you know, race car drivers. So you know that they are now shooting a 9th Fast and Furious movie.
That is true.
Charlize Theron is in this one again too. I hope they don't waste her like they did in the last one that she was
in. Oh, in 8?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a good turn for her, which is weird because she seemed to be having a lot of fun.
Listen, when you put Furiosa in a movie and you don't put her behind the wheel of a vehicle, what the hell is wrong with you? You have Furiosa in your movie. I love her so much in Fury Road. Oh my God, she's unbelievably great in that movie. So, I remember when Fury Road came out, there were guys complaining that it was too female driven. You know, because Max is kind of a secondary character in it, which is true because the movie belongs to Charlize Theron essentially. But it's like, shut up.
it's something different. There's already been 3 other Mad Max. Focused Mad Max movies.
Yeah.
If you know.
And I really liked what Tom Hardy did as Max. I thought he was great. But, you know, I mean, what can you say about that movie? About Fury Road? I mean, you know, we have to put together the decade list. I just have to figure out the other 9. Because I already know what number 1 is. Best movie of the decade. It's Mad Max Fury Road. That's a simple choice.
And you're not alone in that. A lot of some publications have done their end of the decade a little early,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know. On the horizon, I don't really see a whole lot coming out that's going to challenge, you know, the last 10 years necessarily. Might be some stuff that winds up on the best of this year, but I don't know about the last 10 years. But Fury Road popping up in the top, at least the top 10, if not the top 5, and a lot of lists.
Yeah, I mean, it's without question. So, all right, well, we got to get those lists going. It's that time of year, too, where you just got to start thinking about your top 10 lists and all that cool stuff. And we'll have Steve and Eric come down to the studio at the beginning of January to bust out our lists, and that's always a good time. That's always a good time. So figuring out what's going to be on those lists, we got to figure out performances and all that stuff. I can't believe it's already, you know, we've already got another year in the bag here,
mm-hmm. and another decade in the bag.
Another decade, yeah.
I graduated both high school and college over the last 10 years.
Wow,
it's weird to think about.
Yeah, well, I'm much older than you.
Yeah,
graduated high school in 1983. I remember seeing Jedi a week before I graduated and hating it. A bunch of us went to the golf mill to see it. Like, and I remember because it was we were all preparing to get out of high school, to graduate from high school, and then we went to go see Return of the Jedi. And I remember being very disappointed by it. So it was 83, though. Blue Thunder came out that year, too. I remember I saw Blue Thunder at a sneak preview at the Esquire Theater
after they had a, you know, special sneak preview of it. After Meaning of Life, like I had seen Python's Meaning of Life for like the 20th time or something, and then Blue Thunder was afterward. That was a good double bill. So, all right. So, did you ever have a Big Mouth Billy Bass?
Thankfully, no.
No?
But one of my neighbors had it in his, like, den, in his sports cave.
Uh-huh.
And I loved it as a kid. I thought it was really funny. Then it got pretty tiresome pretty quickly.
Yeah. So, the what we're going to talk about here is, here's the story that we've got about the Big Mouth Billy Bass. A bar has 70 of them. Have you seen the footage?
I have seen the footage. Saw it on WGN TV.
You know, you want to know the best use of the Billy Bass ever?
Give me that devil fish. Give me that fish. Give me that devil fish. Give me that fish. What if it were you hanging up on this wall? If it were you in that sandwich, you wouldn't be laughing at all.
Greatest commercial jingle of all time.
I mean, it's an impressive use.
I can't believe they just don't bring that back every year, you know, because I know right around Lent is when, you know, the filet of fish, they really push the filet of fish. And they just need to bring that commercial back every year. I can't believe it's just not perennial.
Well, that was... Oh, it's 10 years ago.
Yeah, no. A long time ago.
10 years ago, that first debut.
Yep. I love it. The first time I saw it, I was just like beside myself. I was laughing so hard. But anyway, so the Big Mouth Billy Bass, the bar has 70 of them. We love a good story about a bar that goes above and beyond for its patrons, whereas many institutions provide a mere jukebox or live acoustic performance to entertain customers. The Royal Palms Shuffleboard Club in Chicago... You ever been there?
No, I don't play shuffleboard.
The Royal Palms Shuffleboard Club in Chicago understands that what people really want is a wall of 70-plus Big Mouth Billy Bass animatronic fish novelties, serenading them with a playlist of updated hits. According to WGN9, Royal Palms co-owner Ashley Albert coordinated with experimental designer Adam Lassie to bring the stairwell's fish wall to life, and choreographed the props singing in with their fin flapping. We created a custom hardware and software and editing software to make all of this happen, Lassie said. He explains that they began by dissecting each fish to rewire them, which is one more visual to add to the already nightmarish carousel of Big Mouth Bass, Billy Bass imagery currently squatting in our collective memory. WGN9 notes that the fish currently sings Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees, Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads, and Choices by E-40. Asked why she would undertake such a project, Albert said, "This was a big blank wall, and I wanted something for people to enjoy on their way up to our roof deck. I've raised the price now in the market of Big Mouth Billy Bass fish." Okay. So there's 70 of them. I saw the stuff I saw it on TV. It's pretty hilarious, actually. What is Choices by E-40?
It's a hip hop song. And E-40 is, I think, I want to say popular in like St. Louis. I want to say.
All right.
But he just sings about making choices.
Not familiar.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so the fish sing that, Staying Alive and Once in a Lifetime.
Not Take Me to the River?
Yeah, you would think, right? So, obviously the Big Mouth Billy Bass is a novelty item. And so we're going to take a break here for news, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the most nostalgic, popular, and useless novelty items ever. And there have been plenty, as you know. And I'm sure that you know, some of these fads and some of these novelty items, I bet a lot of us had these novelty items back in the day. maybe still do. So, all right, we're going to break here. The news is coming up, and then we're going to talk about the most nostalgic, popular, and useless novelty items ever. 312-981-7200. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m., and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we've got a very exciting Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's game. The Hawks had a great weekend. So, yeah, novelty items is what we're talking about. The Big Billy Bass Fish is a novelty item. And we've got some of the most nostalgic, popular, and useless novelty items of all time. How many of these have you had? 312-981-7200. Here's what they say. Novelty items, by definition, are an object that serves absolutely no practical purpose whatsoever. Typically, they are only sold because of their uniqueness or just for the humor factor, although they can also be sold as something new, hence the term novelty. There are some objects that start out being novelty, like Frisbees and hula hoops, only to later move out of the novelty market and into the more established, commonly used goods market later on. There are even food items that are described as novelty items when they first come out, like deep-fried Mars bars. The earliest recorded reference to novelty items was by French mathematician Pierre Harangon. In the early 1600s, he invented a goblet that let you spy on people while drinking via a mirror. What? The most popular novelty item in recent history was, of course, the Big Mouth Billy Bass. And between 2000 and 2001, it was estimated that nearly 20 million pieces were sold. Holy cow. So even if you have never bought these types of items, and you don't plan to buy any in the future, we are sure that you will find it entertaining to see what sort of novelty items other people are buying. And here we go. We got some texts already coming in. Let's see. 847 area code says the Pet Rock and the Chia Pet. 847 area code says the Pet Rock did many tricks, roll over, stay, play dead. I had a Pet Rock.
Really?
Yeah, in the 70s.
What? Well, did you buy them or did you just
No, you buy them. Yeah, you go to the store and you buy the Pet Rock and you got a little certificate with it. You could name it. This is the 70s, man. People were blowing a lot of weed. That's why.
Yeah. Were there at least like eyes on it, like googly eyes or something? Or was it just
a rock?
Oh, wow.
Paul in Portage Park says, I had a Talkboy recorder, just like the one from Home Alone 2. Love being able to record anything and play it back anytime, just like Kevin. I don't know what any of that means. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't remember anything about Home Alone 2, except that I hated it. That's the only thing I remember about it. Let's see. Here's Elizabeth on WGN. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Nick. I was the sad recipient of two, which you already mentioned, the Chia Pet and the Pet Rock.
Yes.
What a waste of money.
Yeah, the Chia Pet is just weird.
It was annoying.
Yeah. All right, Elizabeth.
Good night.
Good night. Yeah, the Chia Pet, you know, I like when they get the specialty Chia Pets, you know, like when it's like where it's going to be somebody's hair.
Yeah, I had a Scooby Doo one.
The Scooby Doo Chia Pet?
That was a good Chia Pet.
Yeah. yeah. We'll see which ones they sell this year. All right, well, here's some more novelty items. How about this? The umbrella hat. They still sell those?
I guess so. The good old umbrella hat.
The umbrella hat. You definitely don't wear this as a fashion statement. How about this? Dehydrated water. What? Sold by Bernard Food Industries. These are basically empty cans with the words Bernard Dehydrated Water on the side. I've never seen that before. Have you seen that?
Not in a store, but I've seen people with, it's just a gag. It's just a really dumb gag of dehydrated water.
Bernard Dehydrated Water.
And if you, on some of the new ones, if you open the cap, on the bottom of the cap, it just says, seriously, what did you expect? It's an empty can.
All right, how about this? Toffee hammers. Apparently, you're supposed to break up sheets or slabs of hard toffee into smaller pieces for consumption. This is assuming, of course, that you somehow managed to acquire an oversized slab of toffee. So I don't even know. So they sell hammers to break toffee apart?
Yeah, it was kind of like a little hammer. Just get a little, what a dumb gift.
I've never even heard of this. Where have I been?
Apparently not eating enough toffee, or you would necessitate a toffee hammer.
Toffee hammers. I didn't even know that was a thing. I mean, I've had toffee. I've never needed a hammer for toffee. Yeah. All right, how about this? Radio hat. Like the umbrella hat, this probably wouldn't help you win any fashion contest, but at least you can listen to your favorite tunes. I don't even know what that means. What is a radio hat?
It's kind of like a big, you know, like the beer hats?
Yeah.
You got the two cans. It's like that. It's like a big plastic hat, but it's got a radio built into it. And you can listen to the radio, but it's all built into the hat.
I don't understand. Where have I been?
Missing out on all the greats.
All right, how about this? Groucho glasses. Now, I know those. Possibly one of the most iconic and wildly used novelty items, Groucho glasses were first marketed in the 40s. That's, all right. How about this? Plastic flamingos. Possibly the most famous lawn ornament in the United States. They were designed in 1957 by Don Featherstone and have become an icon of pop culture. They even won him an Ig Nobel Prize in 1996. You know who loves plastic, who loves flamingos?
Oh.
Joe Madden.
Really?
Yeah.
He's into the pink plastic lawn flamingos?
Yep.
That's so weird.
Yep.
I can't imagine anybody realistically wanting that on their lawn.
Yeah, he's got a collection of them.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Or I see a lot of folk with the fake deer, but apparently that helps keep some animals away if you got a big fake deer.
They also have fake rabbits and stuff that you can put out. But the Groucho glasses, that's one of the, I'm part of a, you know this, right? I'm part of a world record. I'm in the Guinness. Esmeralda and I are both in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah, it was the most people wearing Groucho glasses.
in one event, yeah. It was at a screening. It was an outdoor Grant Park screening of Duck Soup. And they handed out Groucho glasses. You go up and get Groucho glasses. And then we broke the record by having the most people in one place wearing Groucho glasses. And I didn't know Esmeralda at the time, but she was there and so was I. And so that's the world record that we are part of. My old producer, Dan Shagru, also had a world record. He was part of the longest hacky sack line.
Oh, geez.
It was at his high school. It was at St. Pat's. And they surrounded the entire block, the entire school.
And they were all just...
And they just did the hacky sack.
And, wow.
Yeah.
I figured that would have happened at, like, a Grateful Dead concert or Fish, but nope. Old St. Pat's.
I don't know if it holds up. You know, the record might have been broken, but...
At some point.
Yeah. All right, everybody hang on for a second. We're going to jump back in here. We got to take a break here. And when we come back, we will we will definitely talk more about novelty items. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And right now we are talking about some of the useless and popular nostalgic novelty items. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 708 area code says, when I was younger, I had one of those magic eight balls that you shook and it would answer your questions. I think everybody had one of those at some point. Mike from Manuka said in the 70s, everyone had a lava lamp.
Never understood the appeal.
We had one. We had a couple of them. 317 area code says, good morning, Nick. For years, my brother and I would gift each other with a rubber chicken at Christmas, just like Svengoolie had. Eventually, it disintegrated, and it was replaced with a rubber chicken keychain. Okay. 815 area code, the dancing cans that dance to music. Oh, I remember those. 309 area code says, I had a mood ring, me too. Another 70s thing. 224 area code says, years ago, I was into the Pet Rocks. Early 2000, my boyfriend and I were going downtown for some reason, and when we passed a corner, some guy was yelling, rock, rock. I begged him to stop because I really wanted to get one. He laughed and told me that what they really meant, and I was so disappointed. Uh-huh. Yeah, the Pet Rock. Only in the 70s would that become a popular thing. So, here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
I used to work at a Wilderness Canoe Outfitters up in northern Minnesota, and we sold trinkets and stuff, and we used to sell cases of the dehydrated water.
What?
Cases. We couldn't keep it on the shelf long enough.
You gotta
be kidding. Hilarious because people would pick it up and shake it, and it's empty. And it would say right on the can, to reconstitute, just add water.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, seriously, we were getting $5.95 a can.
That's crazy.
And it came 24 in a case. We couldn't keep them on the shelf long enough.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
That's insane.
We used to laugh our butts off.
That's insane. That's absolutely insane. All right, Dave, thanks, man.
Thank you. Okay. Bye.
I mean, it does make a great gag gift. I think. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Or like the tins of peanut brittle.
But I mean, come on,
with the
man.
The snake.
Like five bucks a can for nothing? Jeez.
You get a nice can out of it.
Next here, of course, is the Big Mouth Billy Bass, which is what this whole conversation got started with. This animatronic singing fish was made popular in the 2000s and has since made several television and movie appearances. Next is the Magic 8-Ball. Developed in the 50s, we can only guess how many important decisions were influenced by this silly toy. Everybody had a Magic 8-Ball.
Did you trust it?
Of course. Unless it said, can't, it's a little hazy, come back later, or whatever. Ask again later. So, here's Doug on WGN. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how about the Slinky?
Ah, yes.
You remember that?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And also the chattering plastic false teeth.
Yeah, those are always wacky. Yeah, the Slinky. All right, Doug.
Didn't do a darn thing.
All right, thanks, Doug.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the chattering teeth. I had those, the wind-up teeth.
Well, that's how you knew someone was really a cut-up.
Yeah.
You know, like, this guy's a jokester. He's got those chattering teeth.
You got the chattering teeth because it's comedy.
Get it? Because they move around.
Slinkies, I never really... I mean, I had Slinkies when I was growing up, but I never really understood why.
I loved them.
You can walk them down the stairs.
It was just cool. It was kind of like introducing you to gravity.
Yeah. I never really understood, obviously I think everybody had Slinkies when they were, when they were growing up.
At some point.
Did you ever have the Slinky dog, like in Toy Story?
I did not.
Neither did I.
But that made the Slinky really desirable when I was growing up, because that movie came out in 95.
Yeah.
So
Jim Varney was the voice of that.
Yeah.
Right?
The voice of the dog.
From Ernest.
Hey there, Woody.
But yeah.
It made the Slinky really popular again, that movie.
It made a lot of toys really popular. Mr. Potato Head took off again because of Toy Story. Voiced by the late, great Don Rickles.
I never understood the appeal of Mr. Potato Head. My brother had a Mr. Potato Head. He was really into it. I was like, okay. He, like, take his eyes out and his butt opens.
Or yeah.
Whatever. That's where you keep all the pieces. I didn't really get it.
We used to actually have it for real potatoes. Like, you would use an actual real potato and put the facial pieces on an actual potato. That was something that you actually did. How about the Mexican jumping bean? Basically, seed pods that have been inhabited by the larva of a small moth. Jumping beans will actually jump when heated or held in your hand because the larva spasms. Just don't eat the beans. Yeah, the old Mexican jumping bean. God, I had all these things. All these stupid things. except for the can of air or whatever, the dehydrated water. Never had that. But all this other stuff. I had the Magic 8-Ball. I had the Mexican jumping beans. I had a Pet Rock. There's lots of wasted money over the years.
I know. It's scary to think about.
How about the garden gnome? Originating in 19th century Germany, these little bearded garden dwellers have become the definition of kitsch novelty items. What's the company, is it Travelocity?
Yeah, with the little gnome
that uses the garden gnome?
Yeah.
I love those commercials.
I thought they were pretty funny.
Yeah. Here's Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
Back in my days when I was in the Army and I used to drink, do you remember the vinyl wrappers that looked like soft drink labels?
No.
Yeah, they looked just like, they were spelled wrong, but it looked just like a Coca-Cola can or a Dr. Pepper can or a 7-Up can. They were just a vinyl wrapper, and you'd wrap them around your cold beer, and it looked like you're drinking a can of pop.
Oh, so this was like to hide the fact that you were boozing.
Right.
Oh, okay. I'm surprised I never used them when I was drinking.
I only used them when we were in the Army, you know? I mean, it was,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
Kind of hard to get away with drinking a beer while you're driving a bulldozer, that's but, you know, sometimes you have to.
Exactly.
But anyway.
All right, Rich.
And there was something in the 60s, too, that I remember, because I lived next door to a girl that was in high school, and there were like these rubber jelly troll deals, and I have never been able to find them again. They looked like the Rat Fink style, people or whatever you want to call them. But
yeah,
that was a big thing for the high school kids, and I was only like, I don't know, 10 or 11, and they were always getting them and trading them. So
okay, all right, Rich, thanks, man.
All right. Yep,
take care.
Have a good evening.
All right, you too. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's jokey time, and it's Monday morning. We are talking about goofy novelty items that are nostalgic and popular and useless, and that's what we're jumping into, and we want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Morning, Nick.
Morning.
Got one for you. Do you remember the hand buzzer?
Oh, sure.
You shook somebody's hand. The guy's electric shock, a little electric shock.
Yep. Yeah, the hand buzzer, that was a popular novelty item. You remember thank you, John. You remember the episode, you're not as big a fan of Seinfeld as I am, but when George got the job as a hand model, And Kramer had the hand buzzer.
Yeah. I have seen that one. I hated the stick of gum ones, like the fake stick of gum where you pull it and then like...
And it's like a mouse trap, like a...
Yeah, either a mouse trap, it'd be kind of a mouse trap, or yeah. Buzzy as well. I just right. hated that feeling, and people would try to do it to me all the time. I was like, no...
Those are wacky novelty items.
Yeah, no 10-year-old is walking around with a thing of double mint. Come on. I know it's going to buzz me.
Well, also, it's not double mint. It's like a fake flavor. You know what I mean? So even that's a giveaway. Like, that's not real gum. That's not an actual brand of gum, because you can't sell a novelty item like that with an actual brand name on it. So it would have to be some sort of offshoot of that. So that's a dead giveaway that it's not real. Um, 847 area code says, my brother has a pink t-shirt designed by Joe Madden with a flamingo on it that says, if you look hot, wear it. It's great because he can pull it off and you can't miss us on TV when we sit in the bleachers at a Cubs game, and I'll miss Joe.
Oh.
815 area code says, the spinning light that would make an orb as it spun. Um, 708 area code says, rabbit's foot keychain. Yeah, man, remember when people had the rabbit's foot for good luck? Rabbit's foot keychain. 773 area code says, creepy crawlers make on a hot plate, 8-year-olds. Okay, 608 area code says, silly putty. I remember silly putty. Yeah, used to have silly putty. All right, what about this? Horse head mask. Originally sold as a novelty Halloween costume in 2003 by Archie McPhee, they claimed that a person wearing a horse head mask looks downright disturbing. Today, however, it has made the transition from novelty item to meme. People walk around with horse head masks on? I've seen it. Yeah. All right. Here's Rob on WGN. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how are you guys doing this morning?
All right, what's up?
Okay, well, I'm an avid fisherman, and you can even see these. I think they might even have them in Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops sometimes. Anyways, they've got the Budweiser beer cans, or you know, the other ones that they put, like, fins on, and then they'll put treble hooks and everything, and they'll be selling those things for fishing lures. Invariably, you got some nut up in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan, swear to God up and down that he caught the biggest bass or northern or walleye on one of them things, you know, and everybody just be laughing at him.
Yeah.
But, and then I can still remember the original instructions for the Pet Rocks where if Pet Rock is swinging, it's windy. If Pet Rock is white, it's snowing. If Pet Rock is wet, it's raining. If Pet Rock is warm to the touch, it's hot outside.
Yeah. Yeah, the old good old Pet Rock. Yeah, no, that was a thing. That was a thing. All right. Thank you, Rob. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. What is Zoodirk? This board game... was part of the Boonabee novelty products line. They were manufactured starting in the 50s. It had unplayable rules. I have no idea what that is. Z-U-D-I-R-K. Zoodirk. You ever hear of that? No?
That's a new one.
Zoodirk. Never heard of it.
Zoodirk.
Z-U-D-I-R-K. They said it was a board game that was... manufactured starting in the 50s. It had unplayable rules. What does that mean? Why don't you Google Zoodirk and see what happens? What pops up?
Okay, so it was also known as Boonabee, I guess.
Boonabee.
Yeah, it was the name of a line of purposely useless novelty products. Promoted as if they were useful via carefully written marketing hype. And they were apparently created by radio host Al Crowder, of all people.
Al Crowder?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Very odd.
How about the bubble pipe? Patented in 1918, these were one of the first mass productions of bubble blowers. I remember the bubble pipe. I had one of those. How about the Dealey Bobber? I don't have no idea what that is. Dealey Bobber. D-E-E-D-E-E-L-Y. Bobber, B-O-B-B-E-R. Never heard of it. Invented in 1981 by Stephen Askin, these novelty headbands are a common party favor today. What is that?
The Dealey Bobber?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just kind of like a headband with two, almost like antennae on them.
Oh, that's what they're called?
Yeah, with a little, they'll be either puffy or, you know, maybe just kind of shinier, like there'll be stars, butterflies.
I didn't know that they were called Dealey Bobber.
Yeah. That's what you call them, is a Dealey Bobber.
No idea. Chattering teeth, which we just talked about, originally called Yakety Yak Talking Teeth, when they were released in 1949. All you have to do is wind them up and watch them clang together. Wacky. Yakety Yak Talking Teeth. That's pretty funny. Squirmy. Also called magic worms, these little furry creatures have a string attached to them, which you can pull on and make the worm look alive. Squirmy. Not familiar with that either.
It almost looks like fishing tackle. Like you just kind of pull on a string and they wiggle around. They're really, really dumb.
All right. So you just, it's so, okay. How about the expandable water toy? Following the development of super absorbent polymers, these toys became a novelty hit. They will expand up to 500% after being placed in water for several days. So what is that? So what do? You just you get it and you stick it in the water and then...
Yeah, they come like really small. I used to get one. They would be like little army men. But you'd throw them in water for however, like maybe a day or something, or however long, and they just grow. They just get giant because they suck up all the water. And then you're just kind of like, wow, that's really cool. It's really big now. And then you're
done.
That's
it. And that's it. That's the whole.
Yeah. But for that whole waiting period, it was kind of fun to watch.
To watch it grow.
Yeah. Because you're just like, wow, how'd this thing get so big? And then once you realize that's all it does, it kind of loses the luster.
Okay. Bobblehead. Well, come on. We all know that. What list of novelty items would be complete without the ubiquitous bobblehead, as they say? We have some good ones in the office, including Gritty.
Sometimes that scares me.
Gritty?
Looking at the Gritty one.
Oh. I got a Pee Wee Herman one, too.
Yeah.
Pat Foley. Jonathan Taves is in there. Gritty, I think, is my favorite, though.
He's a good bobblehead.
Yeah.
Well, those Funko Pops, are they bobbleheads?
No.
Nah. Bobble? No?
Mm-mm. No.
Some people are just real. I don't
know. I have one of Dana on my coffee
oh,
table.
Oh, yeah.
Dana, my future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo.
Have you showed her? Have you?
Yeah, like, I've taken a picture of it, and I've shown it. When I got it at Flashback. And I immediately took a picture of it and sent it to her. I was like, look what's on sale here. And she had, at first, she had no idea that she even had one. Now she knows. You know, obviously, she knows now. And people bring it, you know, people bring them in boxes for her to sign, you know, whenever she makes appearances and stuff. But I was the first one to show her. I was like, look, there's a Funko thing of Kelly Maxwell. And she was like, what? She had no idea. But yeah, I have a little Dana DiLorenzo on my coffee table.
She could just nod her head, shake her head,
just say hi to her. But I've got one in the office. There, we've got one of Carl from Caddyshack, Bill Murray.
True.
Bill Murray. So,
All right. Of course, the lava lamp. Developed in 1963 by a British accountant, these novelty items have become a staple of college dorm rooms everywhere. Yeah, the lava lamp. They were all the rage in the 70s. I remember we had like two or three of them when I was younger. You sit there and look at them. That's because everybody was high in the 70s. Let's blow some weed and look at a lava lamp for an hour and a half.
Did you ever have the unfortunate incident of shattering one?
No.
Oh man, it's bad.
Is it?
Yeah, trying to clean those up.
I can imagine.
Bad.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's kind of like when you spill detergent.
Oh.
It's just a nightmare to clean up.
It's the worst.
And most people who have a lava lamp still have like carpeting, usually shag carpeting.
Yeah.
So that breaks on the carpeting. You basically just replace it.
You mentioned how hard it is to clean up detergent. People, you know, for the years that I worked at the Jewels, people were like, what's the worst, you know, cleanup that you have to do? Like if somebody breaks something, and the worst is liquid detergent. It's the worst. Oh, how about x-ray specs? I had x-ray specs.
Did you have to send away for them?
Yeah.
Like in the back of a
comic book, yeah. Long sold under the slogan, see the bones in your hand, see through clothes. These typically oversized glasses have become a well-known novelty item, and no, they don't actually let you see through anything. But the mechanism by which they create their simplistic illusion has been patented. Okay. Yeah, I had those. The x-ray specs. I don't remember why I had them. But I did. So. More texts are coming in right here. We got weather, right? Yeah, we got weather. I'll give you guys the weather, but let me mention a couple of texts here. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. A 920 area code says, you want to talk about a waste of money? How about Beanie Babies? Man, I remember when they were all the rage. The Beanie Babies. That really was a huge fad in the 90s. 224 area code says, name bracelets that guys wore and used to ask girls to go steady back in the 60s. I can't tell you how many I had to replace because they kept falling off. Okay. Tom from Bartlett says, anyone mention fuzzy dice or that stupid dog with the moving head? Oh, yeah. You put that in the back of the car. In the back window of the car, you'd have the dog with the head moving. Yeah, that was always a big one. Fuzzy dice hanging from the rearview mirror. 219 area code says, there used to be T-shirts in the early 90s where the picture on the front changed color with body heat. Oh, yeah, I remember those. They would change color, and you can actually put a handprint on it. Also, a digital pocket pet. It was a keychain, and you had a dog or a cat. It beeped, and when you had to feed it and bathe it, yeah, those were like what were those things called? Actually,
Tamagotchis.
Yeah, Tamagotchis. And you had to feed them.
Yeah, you had to there were just a bunch of digital chores you had to do with it.
Where's fun? How is that fun?
It's not.
How is that? Why? How is that even remotely fun? Don't you want to have fun with toys? You going to take care of this thing? Yeah. Beanie Babies. Man, oh, man. Sue. All right. What do you guys think? Novelty items. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
I feel you touch me in the pouring rain, and the moment that you wander
far. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And how are you? We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We have a very exciting Blackhawks Express to play back. Good weekend for the Hawks. Yeah. And, yeah, so and more coming up here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Right now we're talking about novelty items that we've all had these goofy little novelty items. For instance, a person texted in sea monkeys. Did you ever have the sea monkeys?
Yeah. So stupid.
Unbelievably stupid.
What? I'm not even sure what they were.
Well, they're brine shrimp.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous because that's the most false advertising I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you see the ad for the sea monkeys and they're like living in, you know, they've got clothes on and they're laughing and the, you know, and they live in their little, it's like their own little world. They have a, you know,
and then
you get it and you put the damn thing in the water and it's little brine shrimp and they don't even do anything.
Yeah. You could have. I just imagined that there would be like a little sea monkey dad going off to the sea monkey office.
Well, yeah, they're wearing like hats and they're drinking tea and stuff in the ad, and then you just dump this crap in the water and nothing happens. You're just looking at it. I remember being massively disappointed with sea monkeys when I was a kid. It's the most. If you look up sea monkeys, if you look up like the ad for sea monkeys. Seriously, they're like, you know, they're families. They're sitting around. They got clothes on. They're, you know,
and they always have like the little, like the three pronged head, like they're almost like a little crown.
Yeah, and they didn't look anything like that.
So eager to please, they can even be trained.
No, they can't.
Enter the wonderful world of amazing live sea monkeys.
No, that's not that's not right. Yeah, but say, you know, like I said, I had them when I was a kid. So, let's see. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi, Nick. Do you remember those flesh-colored rubber hands that Walgreens had?
Sure.
They had wires in the fingers and all that, and such and such on the end. But, you know, everybody, you know, like they'd have a demonstration model in the aisle, and of course everybody put the middle finger up.
Yeah.
Or they take two hands and made it look like they were shaking hands.
Yeah.
Okay, and then there were Super Balls. I remember there was only one size of them for a long time, and then they made, like, different sizes and stuff. I knew a guy that bought one time, and he really gave it a workout on the street, and it lasted, like, 20 minutes. Yeah. He just bought it at the store and bust the hell out of it, and it broke up in about four pieces.
Yeah, yeah, the old Super Ball. Yeah, all right, John. Thanks.
I don't know if they make them anymore.
I think they do.
Oh yeah, they
probably do. Yeah, I'd love to have some more.
Yeah. All right, John. Thank you.
Talk to you again. Bye.
Super Ball.
Those are. I mean, they're a novelty item, but they're at least fun. You can throw them real hard.
See how many times you can bounce them.
Yeah,
I it was funny because, like, you know, you're sitting around your house or something, just slam the thing on the ground and watch it bounce off the ceiling and hit the wall, and knock over vases and stuff. Yeah,
it's not a fun toy unless you can break something with it.
Well, I mean, that's what we did. That's the only thing that we had fun. You know, if you don't hurt each other or break something, it's not worth it. At least when I used to hang out in the 70s. How about the propeller beanie? Anybody have those? Do people still have those? These days, computer nerds are sometimes referred to as propeller heads, thanks to the former popularity of this novelty hat. The propeller beanie. Anybody still wear those things? I never had one of those. I will say this. I've had a lot of these goofy novelty things that we've been talking about here, but I never had a propeller beanie, I can honestly say. How about the Chinese finger trap? You remember this? That you stick your fingers in it, and as soon as you try to take them out, the trap tightens. Not very useful, but funny. I remember those, the Chinese finger trap. I had those. And, of course, we mentioned the pet rock. Ever since its conception by Gary Dahl in 1975, pet rocks have made the ideal pet. No need to feed, walk, bathe, or groom them. They don't die, get sick, or disobey either. And then The Useless Machine. What?
Yeah, it's kind of a subcategory of novelty things.
What is it?
So have you ever seen videos of like a machine where you turn it on and the only thing it does is turn itself back off?
No.
Like, oh, yeah, you can get these dumb little novelty machines that you flip a switch, a little mechanical finger comes out and turns itself back off, and it goes away. And every time you turn it on, it just goes and turns itself back off, and that's its only function.
Okay, that's just... When people buy this stuff?
Yep.
They says, the useless machine, these come in all shapes and sizes, but the best are the ones that only have an off button. So it just turns it... You turn it on, and then it just turns itself off.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yep.
What do they charge for these things?
Oh, that's a good question.
You know, I'm in the wrong business, man. We should all just come up with like possibly the stupidest ideas we could possibly think of, and I bet we could sell them.
Totally. I mean, this goes for a little less than $15 on Amazon.
Are you kidding me? $15 for a machine that turns itself on and then off. People are spending $15 on that.
Yeah, because then you can put like in front of a cat or a child, and they get really confused by it because they're just bewildered.
So you want to confuse your cat. That's why you're going to spend $15 on it.
I would spend $15 to watch my cat go crazy. If I had a cat, I'd just leave him there.
And speaking of cats, that white cat with that lady screaming meme, I'm done with it.
Oh, you're over it now?
Oh, yeah.
You seemed to like it for a little while, but now you're just past.
There's just too much of it.
Well, that's how these work.
Yeah.
You just overuse them until they're not
funny. I think the cat's adorable.
It's a good cat.
Yeah. Just sitting there at the table with a plate of food in front of him. But it's just too much now. It's too much of it. All right. Well, there you go. Those are some nostalgic, popular, and useless novelty items. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Let's take a quick break. And the news is coming up after this.
This place is going to have everything. Ghosts, ghouls, goblins, my son. And on the dance floor, you'll find both guys from Wham wearing a two-man horse costume. Spoiler alert, they're both in the back. There's a special guest. Have you heard of Blackula, the Black Dracula?
Yes.
Well, they have a Jewish Dracula.
Oh. What's his name?
Sidney Applebaum.
Oh, Stefan. You gotta love Stefan. One of my favorite characters. You know what's really funny is Mulaney, John Mulaney co-created Stefan with Hader. And one of the reasons why Hader breaks so much when he's doing it is because Mulaney would sneak in jokes on the prompter, on the cue cards, that weren't there when they rehearsed. So a lot, like Sidney Applebaum, that, for instance, was not, that was a joke that Mulaney threw in live. So one of the great pleasures of watching Bill Hader is knowing that Mulaney's messing with him. It made it funny every time. Every single time. Yeah. So, anyway, we're talking about our favorite SNL characters. What are the best SNL characters of all time? 312-981-7200. As a wise, wide-eyed, almost undoubtedly MDMA-fueled man once said, yes, yes, yes. It appears that NBC Universal has released a 5-part compilation of every inspired SNL appearance from Bill Hader's Stefan. Weekend Update's longtime city correspondent, and we still presume husband to Seth Meyers. Forgive us, but this compilation has everything, literally from Stefan's debut alongside Ben Affleck in a sketch about two brothers with very different ideas for film pitches, all the way up to Hader's post-cast member visits to Colin Jost and Michael Che. The entire series basically clocks in at around a feature-length film, so strap in on this fall day full of Furbies, MTV's Dan Cortez, and of course, Jewish Dracula himself, Sidney Applebaum.
The Dan Cortez joke was something I had to look up. I didn't know who Dan Cortez was.
Oh, really?
No idea. I just thought it was funny that they kept mentioning this guy, Dan Cortez.
No, he was a big deal on MTV. Dan Cortez. He's also on an episode of Seinfeld. He's the guy who goes rock climbing. They go rock climbing with him, and George, he falls down the... falls. You better step off, George. That's Dan Cortez. Step off, George. Well, some of the best SNL characters of all time. I've got this from TV Guide. Put together a pretty massive list of some of the best SNL characters of all time. The Spartan cheerleaders, Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry. Some people find those characters annoying. I think they're hilarious. So Sherry O'Terry and Will Ferrell. Never been a big church lady guy. I know a lot of people love church lady, Dana Carvey. I've never been a big, church lady guy.
Are you a Dana Carvey fan?
Not really.
Yeah. He seems to be the kind of guy that either he connects with you or he doesn't.
Yeah.
I
will say this. His TV show was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
His primetime TV show that lasted for, what, 3 weeks?
Maybe.
And the writing staff and the people that were involved in that show are all comedy superstars right now. That show was very funny.
Well, I know Hulu had a documentary about it.
Yeah.
I want to say last year it debuted.
Yeah.
And the single greatest moment was when they talk about how they were going to be following, because they followed Home Improvement. And they talk about how they were going to be following a very special episode of Home Improvement.
Oh, man.
And they play back this bumper for it, where it's like, you know, very serious Tim Allen's talking to Jonathan Taylor Thomas about possibly having, like, cancer or something like that. They said a very special Home Improvement, followed by the Diet Mug Dr. Root Beer Dana Carvey show. and they have Stephen Colbert losing his mind laughing.
Yeah.
Can't believe that ran on TV.
Yeah. No, that show was really great. And I mean, you look at the people that were in that writer's room. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, Stephen Colbert's like first big job.
Yeah,
he had Steve Carell as well. Robert Smigel.
Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
Smigel. I love that guy.
That guy's a maniac.
By the way, Triumph was on The Masked Singer last week.
Oh yeah, yeah. Is that his most lasting creation, you think, Robert Smigel's
Triumph?
Oh,
yeah.
Just...
Yeah. I mean, he's brilliant. Robert Smigel's brilliant. You know? You know, people who don't know who Robert Smigel is, you know, because, I mean, he's Triumph, obviously, but you never see him because he's, you know, he's got the puppet. But he is the guy in the Superfan sketch that nobody knows who it is. That's Smigel. He said, who's that guy? Because you know who the other guys are. You know, right. George Wendt, you know Chris Farley, you know Mike Myers. It's that other guy. Who's that?
It's Robert Smigel.
That's Smigel.
And he's also in Marriage Story. He's the marriage counselor.
Yep. He's been in a lot of great movies. So all right, how about this? Now we're shooting with gas.
Got some mustard on it now.
Mary Catherine Gallagher. I adore Mary Catherine Gallagher. Superstar Molly Shannon's socially awkward Catholic school girl succeeded because of her manic energy and complete commitment to physical comedy. Whether jumping through walls, smelling her armpits, or navigating wild mood swings, Shannon always delivered, making the character a fan favorite that eventually earned its own feature film. And I love the movie.
That's a weird movie, too.
It's a very weird movie.
Will Ferrell is both the love interest and God. He's like Jesus or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know, I adore Molly Shannon. I love her. She's my favorite female cast member in the history of Saturday Night Live. And you know, will do anything for a laugh. So, but yeah, I love Mary Catherine Gallagher. So, Yeah, they reran the Jerry Seinfeld episode Saturday night at 9, and there's a Mary Catherine Gallagher in that. the best Mary Catherine Gallagher sketch is when Gwyneth Paltrow hosted, and she wants to join the gang. Like, Mary Catherine Gallagher wants to join the gang, and then they're in the girls' bathroom, and then she just, at the end, goes nuts and knocks down all the urine or knocks down all the bathroom stalls.
Yeah,
water flying all over the place. I worried for her safety all the time. She goes flying through chairs and everything. So, all right, let's take a quick break here, and then who are your favorite Saturday Night Live characters of all time? 312-981-7200.
Let's go out with something really hot for these folks. A big hit out of 77. Ah, Star Wars. Nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars. Don't let them end. Ah, Star Wars.
Accompanied by Paul Schaefer. Classic character right there. Nick the Lounge Singer. The great Bill Murray. We're talking about some of the best characters, SNL. Next on this list is the ladies' man. Ooh, it's a lady. I got my Courvoisier. Tim Meadows. Very funny. Mango, Chris Kattan. Hilarious. You're not a fan of Chris Kattan. I don't understand that.
He seems like a really nice guy. I think the Roxbury stuff is pretty funny. The rest of it, hit or miss for me. I don't know.
I think he's great. Of course, we mentioned Stefan. The Blues Brothers. The Roxbury guys. You know what the best Roxbury sketch was? Jim Carrey. It was hilarious. How about this? 773 area code says the Martin Short character, the nervous lawyer. Yeah. He's very sweaty. He's always got the cigarette in his hand. Rob Schneider's character, Richard Lamer, who just sat by the copy machine and came up with stupid variations on people's names when they came to make copies. Yeah, that was a pretty classic character right there. I think the funniest sketch that they did was when Sting was the host. When Sting was on there. Hilarious. Ike from Country Club Kills says Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan as the Roxbury guys are great. 808 area code says Kate McKinnon when she does that alien abduction sketch. Well, that only really, really works if Ryan Gosling is on. The first time they did that, and Gosling was losing. Well, Ryan Gosling is on the verge of breaking every time he hosts the show.
But I love that about him because you can tell he's trying so hard to keep it together.
He's also having a really good time. You can tell he's having a really, really good time. But that alien abduction thing, the first time they did it, it was just so hilarious to see him lose it.
I personally like when he was the dad who's got
the mustache
and his daughter's friend is hitting on him.
Yeah, Eddie Bryant.
Yeah. She was going for it. It was so weird. I loved it.
773 area code says John Lovitz. Yeah, that's the ticket. That's where he's the professional liar.
Yeah, pathological
liar. Pathological liar, yeah.
Yeah, I was the president of the Pathological Liars Anonymous.
Mary says Sally O'Malley. I'm 50 years old. One of my favorite characters of all time. The original SNL cast had the best characters. Lisa Lubner and Todd. The Coneheads, the Killer Bees, the Billy Goat Crew, Two Wild and Crazy Guys, Bill Murray's nightclub singer. All very memorable. But man, did Belushi hate the Bees. Oh, did he hate doing that. He hated the costume. He hated the, you know. And so he was purposely like they had to wear those what was it called earlier that we talked about, the novelty items, the thing you stick on your head.
Oh, the like deedle boppers.
Yeah.
Deely boppers.
He hated that. He hated that and would try to make the antennae swirl around differently, but it would get laughs. It would backfire on him and it would get laughs.
So then he'd have to do it again.
He hated the Killer Bees sketch. Hated it. You got Wayne and Garth.
Love them.
Mike Myers, Dana Carvey. Me, not so much. Not so much.
I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Excellent.
Babette, from played by Nora Dunn. Unfrozen caveman lawyer.
Your world scares me.
Here's Pete on WGN. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
I was going to talk about Sumpin' Claus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I forget who played that. I forget his name now.
Well, it's Kenan Thompson.
Yeah.
Kenan Thompson. Yeah.
Didn't Eddie Murphy do something similar to that?
Well, he did Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other stuff. But Kenan Thompson, by the way, now has the longest tenure in SNL history. He's been on the show longer than anybody else. But, yeah, Kenan Thompson, he's got a lot. I mean, what's his, I can't remember his character's name on What's Up With That, which is one of the greatest things ever. Thank you, Pete. DeAndre Cole?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. DeAndre Cole.
DeAndre Cole.
What's Up With That is one of the greatest. I remember the first time my ex-wife and I were watching, and we saw it, and we were laughing so hard. And like when we went to commercial break, I was like, was that maybe the stupidest thing we've ever seen? Maybe?
Are we sure it's real?
And I can't even tell you, you know. And then every subsequent one got funnier and funnier. And it was just a one joke thing, you know. It was just the same joke over and over again. And Sudeikis with the red tracksuit.
Doing the running man.
Fred Armisen with the saxophone, always smiling with the long hair, and of course, Hader as Lindsey Buckingham. It's just,
but nothing will beat when Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, when Lindsey Buckingham actually showed up. Yeah, when he showed just up,
ridiculous.
It was
ridiculous.
So it was so funny. You know, before Kenan Thompson leaves, you know, whenever he's going to leave the show. They need to bring all those people back and do one final What's Up With That.
I think they will.
They have to. I mean, I realize everybody's moved on, you know, to other stuff. But bring Sudeikis back, bring Hader back, Fred Armisen, get them all back there. Gilda Radner as Judy jumping on the bed with a... and always with a slip on her head always made me laugh. Well, that Gilda Radner was just very, very special, and that character is very funny. 765 area code says Dana Carvey's burnt out British pop singer. She's chopping broccoli. 8312 area code says Christopher Walken's the Continental. That's just legendary. 219 area code says Stuart Smalley. Great movie. Stuart Saves His Family. That had no business being as good as it was. And then 815 area code says News for the Deaf, Garrett Morris. Our top story tonight. So, all right, more memorable characters from SNL. That's what we're talking about, 312-981-7200. And we'll jump back into it after this break.
I don't care what your mama says. Christmas time is near. I don't care what your daddy says. Christmas time is near. All I know is the Santa sleigh is making its way to the USA.
Funny every time. Every time. We're talking about some of the best characters in SNL. And by the way, we got the news coming up at 5. But before that, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We have a Blackhawks Express to play back, too. So we're jumping in. What are your favorite characters, SNL characters? Buckwheat. Eddie Murphy. Linda Richman. Coffee Talk with that was Mike Myers. The best one was when Madonna showed up, or Barbara Streisand showed up, and Madonna was on. It was Roseanne Barr and Madonna were on the Coffee Talk, and then Barbara Streisand showed up. Nobody knew that she was going to be there. The Coneheads, which were mentioned already. Wild and Crazy Guys were mentioned already. No, man, Nat X. Chris Rock. Hilarious. It's funny because he, you know, that was one of the only times he ever really did shine on that show. Because, you know, we all know that Chris Rock is brilliant now, you know, and very, very funny. But he was not very good on the show. They didn't give him a lot to do. But Nat X was funny. It was. Debbie Downer. Oh, my God. That first, the first time they did Debbie Downer with Lindsay Lohan, and they were at Disney World. I remember, you know, an interview with Rachel Dratch where they said, because, you know, like Horatio Sands and Jimmy Fallon were kind of notorious, obviously, for breaking. And so they broke during, you know, rehearsal. And I remember Rachel Dratch told this story about how she was really, she's like, you guys, you can't break. I will kill you if you, you know, this was the very first time that they did the Debbie Downer. And she's like, I don't want you guys to break. You better not break. You better not break. And then she's the one who ends up breaking during the actual. And she was gone. And of course, the classic line is, well, it's official. I can't have children. Margaret Jo McCullen and Terry Rialto, Anna Gasteyer and Molly Shannon. Delicious dish.
That's Schwetty Balls.
Schwetty Balls,
right?
Yeah. Goat Boy, Jim Brewer.
Truly one of the strangest kind of one-note characters of all time.
And for you, hey, remember the 80s? Yeah. Like, what? What? Let's see. Here's Rick on WGN. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Nick. How are you? What about John Belushi and Samurai Anything? Samurai Deli, yep. Samurai Divorce Lawyer.
Yep. Yep.
Go ahead.
I was going to say every time Buck Henry was the host, they did a samurai bit.
Right, but now do you also remember the most disturbing thing Buck Henry did?
The most disturbing thing Buck Henry did? Oh yeah, when he was the babysitter.
Yes, the babysitter taking pictures. How do you think that would play today?
Yeah, it wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. But back then we all laughed at it because we thought it was funny.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Rick.
All right. Take care.
Yeah. The samurai. There was a night when, you know, because it was always Buck Henry. Buck Henry was always the samurai. They would do the samurai sketch whenever Buck Henry was on. And there was the night when Belushi actually cut him, like cut Buck Henry with the sword. And he wore a Band-Aid on his head for the rest of the show. So, so then the rest of the cast wore Band-Aids too.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Well, apparently I didn't know this, that his John Belushi did that based off of Yojimbo.
Oh yeah.
I never would have thought.
Oh no. He was obsessed with the samurai movies.
Yeah.
Obsessed with them. And he did that for his audition. He did the samurai bit for his audition.
Samurai Delicatessen.
They were all hilarious. You know, and he was just... Hans and Franz. Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon.
They hit the pump you up.
Yeah. Let's see. Kenan Thompson is Steve Harvey player. You like the buttons on my suit, player? Turd Ferguson and the rest of the characters from Jeopardy. Yeah, Celebrity Jeopardy was always good. Always good. I mean, obviously, particularly, you know, particularly the with Norm MacDonald as Bert.
Well, because that one, the one I remember with it, the Turd Ferguson one, is also Jimmy Fallon as French Stewart.
French Stewart, yeah.
Grinning like an idiot.
Yeah. Who was the other?
Well, Sean Connery.
Of course, yeah.
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 Which is Daryl Hammond, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Daryl Hammond and Sean Connery. Yeah. Unbelievably funny.
Ridiculous. And it's great because, like, Will Ferrell plays straight man. You know, and Will Ferrell is usually the way over the top. He's the one that's getting all the good laughs, but he plays the straight man, and he's hilarious.
And the fact that potent potables is always a category.
Yeah. I'll take swords for 400. No, that's S words. It's not swords. Rosanna Dana. This 815 area code. 808 area code. Black Jeopardy with Tom Hanks was one of the best SNL sketches. Yeah, you know what? That was also the night of David S. Pumpkins. That was the night that David S. Pumpkins was born. It was also the night that the Cubs clinched it and got into the World Series. But the political sketch that night, without question, was the Black Jeopardy. One of the best political sketches they did during the entire campaign. That was absolutely the best political sketch they did. It was brilliant.
I still can't believe that David S. Pumpkins was that night.
It was.
Two things I never thought I would ever see on TV. The Cubs clinching the World Series and David S. Pumpkins.
David S. Pumpkins, man.
Any questions?
Yes! Several! I remember because, you know, I watched it late because I watched the Cubs. They clinched. They went into the World Series. They made it to the World Series that night. And so I watched all of the celebration, you know, for like an hour and a half or something afterwards. The Cubs, you know, on TV celebrating and all that stuff. But I got a text from Eric and I didn't understand it. Because the text just said David S. Pumpkins with an exclamation point. And I was like, I have no idea what that means. So I texted him back. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He hasn't watched SNL yet. Okay. You'll know. And then, of course, later on, I watched it.
I have to hand it to them. They created something that at least was memorable.
I loved it. I laughed my ass off during that. I just thought it was hysterical. Nick Burns. I love Nick Burns. Jimmy Fallon, Nick Burns, your company's computer guy.
Move.
Move. Canteen Boy. Yeah, Canteen Boy.
Probably one of the most controversial they've ever done.
The one with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
And they did Canteen Boy a couple of times, but the one with Alec Baldwin is the Scoutmaster. That was some of the most biggest complaints they ever got in terms of like phone calls and letters and stuff was that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a remarkably uncomfortable sketch.
Oh, completely.
It's hilarious, but it is remarkably uncomfortable.
Yeah. How about Dunice? She's the one on the... it's Kristen Wiig's weird girl on the Lawrence Welk with the teeny hands and the...
Yeah, little baby
the hand. Big forehead and teeth. Kristen Wiig is really good at playing weirdos, though. All of her characters were a bit weird.
Target Lady was a favorite.
Target Lady was fantastic. How about, oh, please don't make me sing.
Yeah.
Oh, please don't make me sing.
Or whenever, I know it wasn't a character, but when she was from the Vincent Price special thing, when she was from Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
I'm a pirate.
Gloria Swanson.
Yeah.
And that was John Hamm as James Mason. Say Price, where are the whores?
Too old fashioned. But couldn't open the box. Too old fashions.
Yeah. And you know they threw that at him, John Hamm, because he was originally supposed to be... I can't remember.
He was going to be like Cary Grant or something.
I think it was Richard Burton, maybe?
Yeah.
Or something. And they were like, hey, can you do James Mason? All right. And that was between Dress and the final... Mm-hmm. He's hilarious.
It's an amazing James Mason.
No, it's great. And I'll tell you something. That was the... Because I only knew him at that point. I only knew him from Mad Men. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how funny he was. Because he's hilarious. John Hamm is hilarious.
Who is... He's on 30 Rock, the guy with the hook hands.
Yeah.
So good.
He's hilarious. He's absolutely hilarious. And I had no idea because, you know, obviously, you know, Mad Men's not known for its comedy. But, man, he's funny. All right, how about The Lovers, Will Ferrell and Rachel Dratch? That, by the way, is based on one of Dratch's teachers at Columbia.
Ew.
Yeah. It's based on one of her teachers at Columbia.
Is that the same ones that they're in the hot tub?
Oh, yeah.
With Jimmy Fallon yep. and Drew Barrymore. Barrymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dave. David.
Those characters are great. They're just really, really funny. Matt Foley. Chris Farley. That first sketch that they, you know, the very first time that they bring Matt Foley out and he goes through that table. It's just, I'll never forget the first time I saw it. And I first saw it, I was just like, this is just unbelievable. But yeah. 773 area code says Fallon is Barry Gibb. Well, also JT as Robin. It's hilarious.
What I wouldn't give for the Barry Gibb talk show to be an actual talk show.
Oh, God.
I would be doubled over. Bless him.
It's ridiculous. 218 area code said, introduced too late since she would end up quitting at the end of the season. Vanessa Bayer's meteorologist character. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Would do this weird drunk speak during Weekend Update. It was very funny. Hap, I love Vanessa Bayer. I love her, and that character is hilarious. I do wish that she would have introduced that a little bit earlier. They did it 2 weeks in a row because she was leaving. She was leaving the show, and they wanted to get the weather girl in there again with that hilarious doublespeak.
At Don Lazarus.
Don Lazarus. Yeah, Vanessa Bayer, man. Love her. So what about It's Pat?
I never saw the appeal. I never thought it was that funny, especially when they decided to turn it into a movie.
Well, the movie is unwatchable. The movie is, it is, you know, there have been a lot of bad movies based on SNL characters and SNL sketches. I think It's Pat's the worst. I think it's the worst. I thought it was kind of funny. You know, I thought Julia Sweeney, she created a pretty fun character. It's a one-joke thing, obviously.
Well, yeah, and I like Julia Sweeney.
Yeah, me too.
I think the one that actually made me laugh was the one with Linda Hamilton. When it's Pat and Linda Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
That was a particularly funny one. But, yeah, it's just, it's an androgynous character and never reveals what she is. That's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all righty then. Hey, why don't we take a break here for some weather, and then my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we've got a Blackhawks Express to play, and then we'll wrap up the show. By the way, tomorrow, Chicago's very own comedian Kyle Kinane is going to be here. He is funny. Very, very funny. So Kyle Kinane is going to be here, and that's tomorrow's show. So let's take a little break here for some weather.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. There it is, right there. You hear the theme every Monday morning. My dad calls in and tells a joke. You want to start your work week off with a laugh. So we got my dad coming in to tell a joke. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, let's say hello to my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
All right. How's Ma?
Good.
Good. Okay, you got a joke.
Joke number 275.
Wow.
A woman is in bed with her husband's best friend. The phone rings, and the friend hears her say, "Okay, that's fine, wonderful." She turned to her lover and says, "Don't worry, he won't be home for hours without playing cards with you."
All right.
That's a good one, Dad.
All right,
man. Have a good day.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you. You go. There's my dad calling in to tell a joke.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next week. All right. Great weekend for the Blackhawks. They're on a roll, man. They're looking good. And so let's play the Blackhawks Express from last night's game. Chicago!
Close out the weekend on United Center Ice tonight in a battle with the youth-laden Buffalo Sabres, a team that hasn't won in this building in several years. But led by their young captain, Jack Eichel, the Sabres are a hungry, let's say young and feisty bunch. And they're here to upset the Hawks, who've won three in a row and four of their last five. Hawks looking to make it four straight wins. Let's see if they can do it. Down to center ice we go. The two captains face off. The drop of the puck. This one's underway in the Blackhawks control. Connor Murphy in the Hawk zone on the right wing side. Carter Hutton 0-3-2 in his last five starts. Searching for that magic. Now a shot from the right wing board by Reinhardt. Scrambling save. Crawford. Kubalik breaking away. Into the Sabre zone. Down the slot. One hands a shot in on goal. And a clutch save is made by Hutton. Whistle will stop play as Kubalik came entangled with the back-checking Sabre player and fell into the end boards. It looks like he's none the worse for wear. He carries to the right wing boards. Kirby Dach sent him off the puck with a shoulder into the boards. Keith will move it ahead to Shaw. To Dach coming by. To Kubalik. To Dach over the Sabre line down the left. He scores! Kirby Dach! To the backhander finds the top right corner of the Sabre net. And the Hawks draw first blood. They lead 1-0. What a play by the rookie Kirby Dach. The other way comes Sam Reinhart to the Hawk blue line. Coughed up the puck to Olimata. Put it up the left wing. Zach Smith enters the Sabre zone. Fed it down the right wing. Here's Dach with the back. And he scores! Kirby Dach! Another backhander this time. It hits the underneath side of the crossbar of the Sabre end. It ends up in behind Carter Hutton. The first two-goal night of Kirby Dach's career makes it 2-0 favor the Hawks. Shot down to the Hawk blue line by McCabe, taken back by Gustafson. Gustafson and BC getting at it, and they're going to drop the mitts and go right from the penalty boxes. BC throwing a right hand over the top and then an uppercut. Gustafson trying to hold his own. Now Gustafson fires back with a couple rights and over the top with a couple rights, and then he falls under BC. And the scrap is over. So Eric Gustafson with his first NHL scrap. He caught a couple, but he gave a couple as well. Here's Kane in front of the net. Should he score? Patrick Kane keeps the game with point streak alive. Kane snapped it past Carter Hutton. It's a power play goal, and it's now 3-0 Hawks. The draw came right to Kane, who got himself some room in front. He just wristed it past Hutton. Seabrook took it back between the circles. He'll back it ahead to center ice. Saad's got a breakaway over the center line down the left wing. Cuts in front and could not complete the mission. Got it back in front. Kane shoots and scores! Jonathan Toews lights the lamp for the Hawks. It's the Hawks 4 and the Sabres no score. A brilliant play by Saad, who never gave up on the play. He couldn't score himself, but he took it to the right corner and found the captain all alone. Carpenter came along and hooked the puck off the boards to center ice. The Sabres get it back at their line. Dahlin firing it to the Hawk blue line. Keith takes the puck back into the Hawk zone. Over to the Hahn, Hawk line right wing. Gave it away to Eichel, charging down to the net. He deeks and shoots. He scores. Jack Eichel with his fifth goal in two nights off off of a giveaway at the Hawk blue line by DeHaan. And the shutout is by the boards for the Hawks. It's now 4-1 Hawks with 10:21 left in period three. That's a lot of time on the clock. Here now in the slot area, Hawk zone. Rodriguez couldn't pull off a shot. Dylan Strome carries behind the net. Leaves it there for Calvin DeHaan with 2 seconds. One, the Hawks have won four in a row. It's the Hawks 4 and the Sabres 1 as your final score. Kirby Dach with a pair, including the game winner tonight. And the Hawks taking care of business. They're on their best roll of the season. As I mentioned, they've won four in a row. And for the Blackhawks, they've now run their record to 6-1-2 over their last 9 games.
Great weekend for the Hawks. Great weekend. Next game is tomorrow night against the Hurricanes at 7:30. You can hear it right here on 720 WGN. All right. Really quickly, let's wrap this up. SNL characters. Caitlin, Amy Poehler. She was like the hyper girl. Rick, 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 Rick. Horatio Sands. Sully and Zazu. Jimmy Fallon and Rachel Dratch as the Boston teens. Those are great characters. Always funny. The ambiguously gay duo. Smigel. Yeah, that was Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert. Funny every time. Toonces the driving cat. Do you remember Toonces?
I've seen some Toonces.
It's strange. It's hilarious.
It is.
But it every one of them ends with the car flying off the cliff.
Yeah.
We got the samurai already. Gumby, as we mentioned. We didn't mention Gumby. We mentioned Buckwheat.
Yeah.
I'm Gumby, damn it. Landshark. Chevy Chase's Landshark. Candy Graham. He's knocks on the door. Candy Graham. Canteen Boy. Ed Grimley, which is actually a character that began on SCTV. Mr. Bill. That was, by the way, that was created. Did you know that was created by Dan Aykroyd, Mr. Bill?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, that's interesting.
Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar. John Lovitz. The Sweeney sisters, Nora Dunn and Jan Hooks. Clang, 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 go the trolley. I miss Jan Hooks. That's sad. She was so funny. So funny. You know what she's great in? Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
True.
Very oh, true. My God. As the he all been the best, you know. It was her first time doing the tour at the Alamo. There's no basement in the Alamo. So, all right. Well, there it is. The best SNL characters of all time, and there you go. Will Ferrell is hosting next week.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting.
Yeah, it'll be his third time. Third time hosting. All right. All right. There you go.